Okay, good afternoon. I call the Legislative Budget and Audit Committee meeting to order. The time is 1:01 p.m. Today is September 28, 2022. Present today is Representative Hoffman, Representative Josephson, Representative Foster, Vice Chair Representative Tuck, myself, Chair Von Imhoff, Senator Bishop, and Senator Reinbold. On the phone, I believe we have Senator Keel and Representative Hannon. Representative LeBon and Representative Edgemond as well. Thank you. So please silence your cell phones. And then we have Representative Fonholz. So I'd like to open with a sincere thank you to all of you here today, present and on the committee, for joining us to hear the results of the investigation into the circumstances surrounding the termination of previous Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation CEO Angela Waddell. And thank you to counsel for being here today for completing this executive extensive investigation in a timely manner. I am going to start out with a brief review of the circumstances that brought us here today. Per statute AS24.20.156, this committee has the responsibility for providing the legislature with fiscal analysis, budget reviews, audit, and performance reviews of state government agencies to the extent to which the performance of the agencies contributes to the fiscal, financial, economic, and social improvement of the state and its citizens. The Permanent Fund provides nearly 70% of the state government's annual revenue. It is imperative that the fund is protected from political intervention or manipulation to ensure the fund's continued growth and stability. Without that assurance, the fund's sustainability for Alaskans could be in jeopardy. The motivation of this committee to look into the Permanent Fund Corporation Board's unusual behavior was threefold. Number one, this committee wanted to know the circumstances behind Ms. Rodell's termination last December 2021, which was abrupt and without explanation and without a clear plan for a professional and timely leadership transition. Second, as a committee, it is our duty to perform due diligence and learn more about the process by which the Alaska Permanent Fund Board evaluates, supports, and as the case may be, potentially terminate the executive director and CEO of the fund. And third, this committee's statutory purpose and goal is to ensure that the fund, Alaska's nest egg, stays politically independent from both legislative and executive political influence. So, to reiterate, it is of great interest to the LDNA committee to keep the APFC, Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation, politically neutral, to keep it performing at its highest and best potential, and to ensure the board governance is conducted in the most professional manner. Anything short of that risks weakening the fund. So to recap, in January of this year, this committee voted to hire Schwab, Williamson, and Wyatt law firm to conduct a professional, unbiased, independent, and objective investigation to be conducted at arm's length from this committee and from the political process. The result of this investigation is a thorough written report that committee members have in front of them. We will begin, Schwab Council will begin this meeting by reviewing their executive summary, which reviews the purpose and scope of the investigation as well as the activities performed. The section will take approximately 30 minutes. I ask that committee members withhold their questions until after this initial overview is complete. Next, Council will go over the specific findings using the aid of PowerPoint slides. My intent is to stop periodically, perhaps at the end of each slide or the end of a set of slides per subject, depending on what makes sense. I'm anticipating that this will take 3 hours. We could go over, depending, but we have a hard stop at 5 p.m. today, just to be clear. At this time, there is no plan to go into executive session. This meeting will remain public. If, however, it does become apparent that it could be appropriate to go into executive session, the committee does have the right to discuss the merits of this action. At the conclusion of today's meeting, this report, including the full transcripts of all depositions as well as all attached exhibits, will be uploaded electronically to BASIS and available to the public. And finally, at this time, there will be no committee action to consider today, nor a committee vote at the end of this report. The purpose of today is to listen, consider the presentation, and if at a later date the committee would like to propose an action, we may do so at a future meeting. So at this point, I would like to allow counsel to begin.
Thank you. Thank you, Senator Von Emhoff. My name is Howard Trickey, and I will introduce myself and the team that worked on this investigation and report to you, and then give you a brief summary of how we proceeded. I've been practicing law in Alaska for, unfortunately, over 40 years. I've enjoyed it. It's been a great experience. I've focused part of my practice on employment law. I've handled a lot of investigations into employment-related issues for clients, and I've represented both employers and employees during the course of that experience. I've also worked fairly extensively with both private and public boards and their CEOs with governance-related issues. Chris Slotty, my partner, who will do most of the presentation today, has been practicing in Alaska for 20 years. He had a major focus and emphasis on corporate governance issues, worked extensively with boards and CEOs on evaluation of board and corporate performance, and also in the context of having a litigation practice and background. And then this is also Peter Scully behind us, who's been practicing for 10 years with an emphasis primarily on litigation and trial work. I will review what the scope of our engagement is very briefly. As Senator Von Emhoff said, we were engaged to conduct a fair and impartial investigation. We were not given any direction or guidance by the committee, and no one interfered with our work in any respect. I want to emphasize that we're not acting as advocates here today. We're not, in the course of the investigation, did not act as advocates. Our charge was to find out what the facts were and report to you the facts. So we're not making a case on behalf of a client. We're not presenting a claim on behalf of a client. And we're not pursuing any political agenda in any respect. In finding facts, we've applied the general civil standard in civil cases of what was supported by preponderance of the evidence. That means what was more likely true than not true. We have not tried to in any way speculate about motives, and we did not draw any kind of speculative inferences in reporting to you the facts. We don't believe that facts come in the alternative. Facts are a little bit like simple math. 2 + 2 = 4, and in our report we've laid out to you what we found as the facts that are supported by the testimony and evidence of the witnesses who we examined on their oath and the exhibits that we reviewed. In the course of our investigation, we focused on basically three questions. What was the process employed by the trustee to evaluate the executive director's performance that led to the decision to terminate the executive director? What were the underlying reasons the trustee had for their decision to terminate the employment of the executive director? And what, if anything, did political considerations or political influence from the executive branch of government or the governor play in the decision? We found basically, to summarize, there's sort of three ultimate fact conclusions that we've reached, not in any particular order, but we found that the trustees reached a consensus decision that they have lost confidence in the executive director's leadership. The trustees who voted to terminate had separate and independent reasons for why they supported termination, and we lay out with respect to each trustee both the facts and the thinking and the reasoning that they testified to that supported their decision to vote for termination, and why it is that they viewed that they no longer have the confidence in her leadership to move forward. So that's one general sort of ultimate factual conclusion that we reached. The second is that the trustees governance documents have a charter that describes the specific duties and responsibilities of the executive director, and that charter also has a very specific performance evaluation process and outlines performance criteria that should be used as the basis for evaluating the executive director's performance. That those provisions of the charter are reflective of good sound practice for evaluating the performance of executives. But what we found is that the trustees did not follow the Royal Charter provisions with regard to the process for evaluating the executive director and the criteria that they used. They did have a process that they followed. They did have an evaluation instrument that they used, but it was not the one that under their own government documents applied to this position. And lastly, we found that there was no direct or credible circumstantial evidence that the executive branch or the governor exerted any undue influence on the trustees with regards to the decision they made to terminate. There was no prior communications between the trustee and the governor regarding their decision to terminate. The governor's office had no impact or influence on the decision. There were some political considerations and factors that some of the trustees had, but those did not rise to the level of a substantial motivating factor in the decision that they made. So with those general conclusions of the framework for the detailed presentation of the evidence that we'll walk through today's view, I'm prepared to turn it over to Mr. Slotty, and he's going to review with you what are essentially what is essentially the executive summary of the report. The report is in excess of 60 pages in length, and there will be, as Senator Von Imhoff indicated, the complete transcripts of the testimony of each of the trustees, as well as the testimony of the former executive director, Angela Gravel, and supporting visits and documents. I think the transcripts are in the neighborhood of about 400 pages in length, and the other documents are about 300 pages in length. So those will all be part of the complete report. We also have with the report a short report from a consultant who's a consultant in the human resources field who also focuses on executive evaluation, and her comments about and opinions about the process that the trustees did follow, although, as I said, they did not follow the evaluation policy and process that's in their charter and in their governing documents. So with that, I turn it over to Mr. Slotty to proceed.
Thank you. The Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation Board of Trustees Charter and Governance Policy, which we'll refer to as the charter.
Could you state your name for the record?
It's Christopher Slotty with Schwab Williams. So the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation Board of Trustees Charters and Governance Policy, which I'll refer to as the charter, governs the management and operations of the Alaska Permanent Fund. Charter includes a charter of the executive director, which sets forth a detailed description of the executive director's duties and responsibilities. The charter provisions are detailed, specific, and meet fiduciary standards for governance of the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation. The trustees review and modify the charter on a regular basis, and the last revision occurred in September of 2020. The charter also includes an executive director performance evaluation policy, which establishes a process and substantive criteria for evaluating the performance of the executive director on an annual basis. The charter's substantive evaluation criteria directs the trustees to measure the executive director's performance against those duties and responsibilities in the charter through the use of an anonymous survey tool. The evaluation criteria are in large part objective measures of the executive director's performance. Historically, the trustees have not adopted a consistent evaluation instrument or process that complied with the relevant provisions of the charter. While the trustees have evaluated the executive director on an annual basis, the evaluation instrument has changed. For example, the trustees made material changes to the evaluation instrument in 2019, 2020, and 2021, including changes in the individuals who administered the survey and compiled its results, changes in the individuals who actually completed the evaluation survey, and changes in the evaluation criteria themselves. The trustee's annual evaluation of the executive director did not result in the communication of clear, specific goals to the executive director that she was expected to achieve. The executive director received little guidance on whether her performance needed to improve or where she might not be meeting expectations. The evaluation process provided inconsistent feedback. In 2016 to 2017, the executive director received a positive evaluation. In 2016, trustees rated her performance between 4 and 5 on a 1 through 5 scale, with 5 being the highest, in each of 17 evaluation categories, and rated her overall performance a 4.66. Narrative comments were generally universally positive. In 2017, trustees again gave the executive director positive performance ratings of between 4 and 5 in each of 17 evaluation categories. In 2018, the executive director's evaluation started taking on a less positive tone, and average performance scores signed by the reviewing trustees dropped substantially. The trustees' average performance ratings in 12 of the 17 categories fell below 4, and 2 averages ratings below 3, again on a 1 through 5 scale. Those areas were in the areas of staff communication and delegation. For the first time, some trustees criticized the executive director's relationship with APFC staff and began to express the sentiment that the executive director was trying to, quote, manage, unquote, the board to advance her own agenda. At the end of the evaluation, the board tasked the executive director and her team with attending executive leadership training to address concerns raised in the evaluation. Despite the more critical evaluation in 2018, the trustees did approve a 3% merit increase in the executive director's salary. In 2019, then Vice Chair Carl Brady drastically simplified the trustee evaluation tool to just 2 questions requiring a narrative response. 1, what are some things the executive director does well? And 2, how could the executive director improve? Positive responses to the first question highlighted the executive director's passion, energy, and commitment to APFC's performance, as well as her comprehensive understanding of state government and APFC's governing documents and importance. Several negative responses to the second question criticized the executive director's relationship with APFC staff and the board, and again expressed the sentiment that the executive director manipulated the board to pursue her own agenda. Each trustee was asked at their deposition for examples of situations in which the executive director attempted to manipulate the board or pursue her own agenda. Most either disclaimed that characterization or could not provide any concrete specific examples except for Trustee Richards. The few examples that were provided were not concrete and instead related to interpretations or perceptions of the executive director's actions. The critical performance evaluations beginning in 2018 coincided with turnover on the Board of Trustees and its officer position. The evidence does not indicate any substantive change in the executive director's approach to performing their job duties. The critical reviews of the executive director's performance beginning in 2018 may be attributable to new evaluators on the Board of Trustees with different expectations for and perspectives on the executive director's performance. The trustees elected Trustee Moran as chair and Vice Trustee and Trustee Rieger as vice chair at their September 2020 annual meeting in Anchorage. Under the charter, the vice chair serves as chair of the governance committee and is responsible for initiating and coordinating the executive director's annual performance review. In response to reports that prior evaluations had been tense and difficult, Trustee Rieger took the lead to develop a more thoughtful evaluation instrument that focused on the leadership and management of the executive director and the corporation. The APFC retained an independent human resources expert to develop the evaluation instrument and to summarize the results of that evaluation process. The evaluation instrument surveyed the trustees, and for the first time, the executive director's direct reports and a random sampling of APFC staff in what is referred to as a 360-degree review. Evaluators were asked to rate the executive director in 15 categories of performance, and with each area having multiple indicators. The executive director received overall ratings in each of the 15 categories, ranging from 2.89 to 3.89 on a 5-point scale, with 1 being the lowest and 5 being the highest. The lowest ratings on this survey came from the investment team. The narrative comments evaluating the executive director's performance were positive. 5 of the 6 trustees completed this evaluation. The third-party consultant compiled the survey results into a summary report and presented it to the trustees. Even though this was a more thoughtful instrument, the 360-degree review did not comply with the express terms of the charter. For example, the survey failed to reference or incorporate a number of objective evaluation criteria specifically identified in the charter, including achievement of APFC's goals and objectives and achievement of special projects or initiatives set out in the strategic plan. The trustees elected Chair Richards, Trustee Richards as chair, and Trustee Mahoney as vice chair at their September 2021 annual meeting in Kodiak. As vice chair, Trustee Mahoney became chair of the governance committee. The other members of the Governance Committee, appointed by Chair Richards, were Chair Richards and Trustee Riga. Trustee Mahoney, in consultation with Chair Richards, decided to administer the same evaluation tool designed the previous year, but without engaging the consultant who had designed it, coordinated the distribution of the survey, and reviewed and summarized the responses. Trustee Mahoney's rationale for dispensing with the consultant was to save money and because she had administered 360-degree views in the past. She decided to send the anonymous survey to all employees of APSC, thinking that a survey of everyone would be more accurate. The 2021 survey largely replicated the 2020 survey in its context, but instead of limiting circulation of the survey to a small random sample of APSC staff, Trustee Mahoney invited all APSC staff to respond, regardless of whether they had the experience or knowledge base to provide a meaningful review. Trustee Mahoney then compiled and curated the survey responses into a draft summary report for the full board in consultation with APSC's Human Resources Director, Chad Brown. The 2021 survey results showed improved performance scores compared to the 2020 survey in all leadership and management categories assessed in the survey. Average scores from all evaluators in 14 performance categories range from 3.35 to 4.11, with an overall average rating across all categories of 3.6 on a 1-5 scale, with 5 being the highest. Average ratings for trustees and APSC employees who self-identified as investment staff were lower than ratings by APSC employees who self-identified as operations staff. Positive comments credited the executive director with, among other things, overseeing an organization that delivered record returns in a volatile market, overseeing a rapid expansion in assets under management without any evident problems, designing a functioning remote work system early in the pandemic before there was any consensus on best practices, and addressing and managing risk and cyber threats in a responsible manner. Negative comments again cited purported stress in the executive director's relationship with trustees and with APSC's investment staff and referenced a breakdown in the relationship between the executive director and some trustees, with some comments asserting that the executive director was not being candid with the trustees and manipulated information that was submitted to the trustees. The evaluation conducted under Trustee Mahoney's supervision did not follow the charter and did not follow standard human resources practices. In particular, the evaluation tool lacked any meaningful focus on the objective performance criteria prescribed by the charter's evaluation policy, including the achievement of the goals and objectives of the APSC, the completion of specific projects and initiatives set out in the strategic plan for that fiscal year, and compliance with the executive director's charter. The evaluation further failed to comport with best practices because it went to some evaluators with no knowledge or experience with individual performance indicators within a rating category and who nevertheless provided ratings in those categories. Categories and indicators within categories were also occasionally redundant. The evaluation summary prepared by Trustee Mahoney was also deficient. It overemphasized negative comments by including almost all negative comments in the survey, some verbatim, while summarizing some, but not all, of the positive comments. It did not provide a comparison to scores from the prior year when such a comparison showed an improvement in Ms. Rodell's scores. Finally, the evaluation summary Trustee Mahoney prepared did not account for the halo horn effect of extreme rate graders who harbored obvious bias, favorable or unfavorable, toward the executive director. The 2021 evaluation tool did not provide a complete assessment of the executive director's performance. The executive director's annual evaluation was on the agenda for the trustees' quarterly meeting on December 8th and 9th, 2021. The trustees convened an executive session to begin discussion and consideration of the annual evaluation results. The private closed-door meeting extended over 2 days, reconvening on December 9th, 2021. Trustees discussed the executive director's performance in executive session over those 2 days, but never allowed the executive director the opportunity to address their concerns. Initially, there was no unanimous decision to terminate the executive director, although several trustees testified that things were clearly headed in that direction by the end of the first day. The trustees reached a majority consensus to terminate the executive director by the end of the deliberations on the second day. After the trustees' deliberations, the executive director was called into the meeting and advised by Chair Richards the trustees had decided to move to a new direction. The executive director was given the option of resigning or being terminated. The trustees did not provide the executive director the reasons for her termination. Ms. Rodell elected to be terminated and angrily told the trustees that there would be political consequences for their actions. When the trustees came back into public session, Chair Richards, Vice Chair Mahoney, Trustee Feige, Trustee Shook, and Trustee Rieger voted in favor of terminating the executive director. Trustee Moran voted against termination. After terminating Ms. Rodell, the trustees issued a press release that simply stated the fund was moving in a new direction. The trustees gave little or no consideration as to how to explain the termination decision to the public or the legislature. The trustees did not anticipate that the public would seek some explanation for why Ms. Rodell was terminated. Based on the testimony of the trustees, each trustee who voted in favor of termination had different reasons why they believed the fund needed new leadership. The primary consensus reasons that emerged from the trustees' deliberations justifying the termination of the executive director was that the trustees lacked confidence in the executive director's leadership, concerns over the executive director's relationship with the board, and that some trustees lacked trust in the executive director. A majority of the trustees also thought the low scores in the survey from the investment team indicated that Ms. Rodell had not improved her working relationship with the investment team. The trustees thought and feared there was a risk that the corporation would lose top investment talent. For the majority of the trustees, their fiduciary duty compelled them to support termination because the trustees delegated their fiduciary duty to invest funds for Alaskans to the investment team, and retaining a talented investment team was paramount. Although various comments in the 2021 evaluation report cited the lack of trust in and or by the executive director, there was little objective evidence supporting such consideration as a cause for termination. Each trustee was acted under oath to provide concrete, specific examples of what the executive director had done or said that would support such a conclusion. Trustees could not point to a situation in which the executive director actually misled the trustees or withheld or manipulated information, though some trustees voiced unsubstantiated concern that she may have done so. The trustees gave little weight to the performance indicators in the survey evaluation, except for scores from the investment team. Only four of the six trustees actually completed the evaluation survey themselves in 2021. The trustees who voted to terminate Ms. Rodell also gave little to no weight to the fact that APFC has enjoyed record-breaking returns under her leadership. The trustees declined to credit Ms. Rodell for these returns because they attributed them primarily to prevailing market conditions and a team effort led primarily by investment staff. While the trustees chose not to explain the reasons for terminating Ms. Rodell to her when they called her into the executive session or to the public, lack of confidence in the leadership of the chief executive officer is a sufficient reason to support the termination of such a high-level executive. The trustees' subjective assessment of their level of confidence in executive director's leadership is a legally sufficient reason for their decision based on their direct working relationship, communications, and interactions with Ms. Rodell.
We're going to pause there because I see what's next as we get into each individual. Okay. Thank you. But I think we have quite a bit of information so far, and I just want to pause real quickly. So I see the first one with Representative Joseph.
Through the chair, Mr. Slotty, correct? Okay. I guess what caused me to raise my hand was really the paragraph 20 on legal sufficiency. So I've read most of the cases regarding the covenant of good faith and fair dealing, and one might argue that it's my job to protect the state's coffers in every case and not to provide an opportunity to help someone who may sue the state of Alaska. But I view my role as a little bit more neutral than that. This seems like a legal conclusion, but isn't it true that under the covenant of good faith and fair dealing, there would still have to be something a jury would find objectively reasonable? Maybe you're suggesting that it is, but I guess where I'm going with this is there's a belief that at will means at will. But it's sort of a misnomer, isn't it?
Look, Chair, Representative Johnson, through the chair, under the covenant of good faith and fair dealing, there are two covenants or two aspects to that. There's the objective covenant, which is you have to treat employees as an objectively fair manner, and the subjective covenant, which says that you cannot terminate them for an improper basis. What in reviewing the facts, as we saw them, the trustees expressed that they had developed a lack of confidence in the executive director and were concerned about the potential attrition in the investment staff. And that lack of confidence and that concern about the potential attrition in the investment staff would be a legally sufficient reason to terminate an at-will employee.
Mr. Slotty, relevant to what you just said, in the report it says that the lack of trust in candor just couldn't very concretely be explained. So why would that be objectively reasonable?
Through the chair, may I respond to Representative Josephson? I think there are two responses to that, Representative Josephson. First of all, the reasons that the trustees offer for why they lack confidence were supported by their direct experience working with the executive director that had occurred in the 6 months, 9 months before the termination decision, and we'll get into those specific details. But they, from their own direct experience, which they testified about as supporting the reason, explained why they had lost confidence. Those reasons were not false. Usually in a bad faith case, you find that the reasons that the answer offered by the employer turn out to be false, or there's evidence that they're false, or there's evidence that they're implausible, that the trustee's testimony about their reasons, which are subjective in this case, because you're talking about trust and confidence, we found supported by their testimony and supported by the underlying events and circumstances that raised in their minds that this was somebody who did not want to continue to lead the organization. So, and then the second aspect of that is the covenant in this context where you're talking about the senior executive of an organization, the courts in the cases always have an instruction where you may not agree with the employer's decision, their decision to make when it comes to these less objective factors. But in summary, the reasons they advanced were supported by the evidence, even though most of those were things that occurred in a series of meetings and as a result of some tweets, which we'll get into in great detail later. And the nature of none of those reasons we could find evidence that indicated they were false or they were implausible or they were made up in any way.
I'll have more questions. Thank you.
Any further questions?
Thank you, Madam Chair. So we have a objective platform or procedures for doing an evaluation on the executive director that's in your charter, yet you didn't follow that objective process. So is it easy to assume that the process that they did implement could have been on the subjective side?
Representative Tuck, through the chair, the ultimate process they applied certainly in 2020 and 2021 was, this is Christopher Slotty, Representative Tuck, through the chair. The process they applied in 2020 and 2021 was, at least the survey process, was entirely sought out kind of the subjective impressions and comments from the trustees and the APFC staff. So it was very much a decision, at least to the extent that they relied on the survey results, was based on subjective comments, subjective scoring. I will state that, you know, in their testimony, a majority of the trustees put little or varying weights on the survey results in 2021 that are making their decision, their individual decision to terminate Ms. Rodell's employment, and instead relied what appeared to us on their personal interactions or personal kind of what they saw individually with Ms. Rodell as opposed to the actual 2020 survey. But the survey, the process itself did not follow the charter. Following the charter, we think would have been resulted in a more accurate and complete assessment of the executive director's performance.
Follow-up?
I would add that the charter provisions do provide more objective measures of performance and metrics that would be more easy to verify with objective evidence. But that doesn't mean that they can't make subjective consideration, as they did in this case, as a matter of law, I believe.
Is the charter one of the items that we'll be uploading today at 5 p.m.? Do you have that? Thank you.
Yes, sir.
Representative Beck?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I can't help but to think that if you didn't have an objective means of evaluating the executive director, that how the person's subjective view of the director would be skewed in some way to lead. I'll look forward to actually hearing the rest of the report to see, as I know that that possibly there's no unlawful objections to being subjective in your decision to terminate somebody, if that made any sense. But I'm just going back to just because you can doesn't necessarily mean you should. Yeah, I looked at all performances, and I think that it looked like that some of her performances were unintentionally or mistakenly overlooked. I think when you look at a balance of making a decision on whether you want to make improvements with an organization or if you want to cut the head off and start over again, I think that, you know, the two things play a key role in that. But I look forward to hearing what the other comments.
That would be just in this context, Senator Garofano, if I could, the trustees, as Mr. Slotty indicated, who voted to terminate her, they relied on the survey, which we will go over detail, with regard to the scores from the investment team. The investment team, the survey broke out the respondents from, you know, between the investment team and the operations team, and then the trustees, and they also provided that you didn't have to indicate that you were from one demographic group or the other. But the investment team's scores were low. That reflected the trend from the prior evaluation, as well as the investment team's scores were collectively the lowest, and the trustees felt and thought that there was a risk of losing some of the top investment talent that the fund had, and so that was a factor. And to that extent, there was some objective support for that. The scores were lower and from the investment team. They were from the operational side. So it appears that they might be losing some of the investment talent. But from the trustees' perspective, is they delegate the fiduciary duty to invest the funds to the investment team, and that was the paramount consideration for some trustees.
One clarification, Chair. Thanks, Madam Chair. Just in this recent conclusion, said something about that the returns on investment was attributed to the prevailing market conditions, but I thought I saw somewhere previously where it said that there is fantastic returns in spite of the volatile. Was that something that how did you guys come to the conclusion that we had good returns during a volatile market? Was it a comparison to other organizations such as the Permanent Fund Corporation in comparison? Or is that something that statement that the Permanent Fund Corporation came out with, or where was that attributed from?
Representative Puck, through the chair, that was in relation to a comment that a APFC staff or potentially a trustee had submitted in response to the survey.
Oh,
I was just relating what the comments were.
Okay, thank you so much. Appreciate it. So on one hand, they're saying, wow, she did a great job during, or the late Permanent Fund Corporation did a great job during the volatile market. But on the other hand, some are saying that, well, that's because of the prevailing market conditions. Okay, thank you.
So thank you. Thank you for letting me take a brief pause there. A couple things is I do want to let the record state that we have others online and in the room. We have Senator Keel online, Representative Hannon, Representative Lavon, Representative Edgman, Representative Ortiz, Senator Wilson, Senator Muchiki, and then we have Representative Matt Freeman here as well. One comment I'd like to make is in paragraph, the very end of paragraph 18, only four of the six trustees actually completed the evaluation survey themselves. I find that very curious, especially a document that's so important and being used to make such a monumental decision. As we go forward, please slow down just a little bit. We will be going into slightly deeper dive, even though it is still executive summary. We'll be talking about what each trustee has testified, and then, of course, begin discussing specific documents and behaviors such as a tweet, a press release, and so forth. So I felt that it was an appropriate time to kind of take a pause. So let's move forward again. Please state yourself for the record and then continue. Yes. Oh, Senator Ryan, sorry. Brief comment?
Sure. Okay. I would also like to make a brief comment in regards to this, and I had to jump to the conclusion page on 64, and this just is very concerning to me that the trustees did not follow the APFC charter in all material respects with regard to their evaluation of the executive director, and the trustees did not use an evaluation instruments or process to assess the executive director's performance that was consistent with the executive director's performance evaluation policy. And I think you actually just stated that on record. That is a deep concern to me, because what it looks to me just from first blush in the last almost hour is that there was no true objectivity in regarding the removal of her, and it ended up leading to more subjectivity. And that's what concerns me. And I'm also going to put on record right now, I apologize, something unexpected came up with my court case today that I have to head to court, and I just didn't address some issues. So I apologize for that in advance. But I do plan to, I do have staff online, and I do plan to read these reports. So thank you, Chair Bunham, very much.
Thank you, Senator Reinbold. So Mr. Slotty, please continue.
Thank you, Chair. Again, this is Christopher Slotty. So next we're going to talk about how each trustee testified to as to the basis for their decision to either support or oppose termination of the executive director. Trustee Schutt was troubled by a June 18, 2021 press release the executive director issued regarding the impasse in budget negotiations between the governor and the legislature. The press release explained the negative consequences that a government shutdown would have on the APFC. Trustee Schutt viewed the press release as taking aim at the governor and improperly staking out a position in a politically fraught dispute between the executive and legislative branches. Trustee Schutt was also concerned that the press release was inaccurate and that the APFC would be protected in the event of a government shutdown. Trustee Schutt was also concerned about what he described as an unnatural and unhealthy tension between the executive director and certain trustees. He recalled an incident at the September 2021 annual meeting of Kodiak of the Board of Trustees, in which he claimed that the executive director acted unprofessionally towards Trustee Mahoney and unfairly accused her of not acting in the best interest of the APFC. Trustee Schutt also testified that, based on his experience serving as an executive and on boards of directors, when a senior executive's leadership with the board is negative, it can be better and more effective for the organization to go in a different direction than attempt to divert the resources and time needed to try and fix the problem. Finally, Trustee Schutt expressed concern about the low scores on the survey from the investment team. Trustee Schutt expressed concern about the risk of losing the top members of the investment team. Trustee Mahoney's primary concern was the tension between the executive director and APFC's investment staff, as reflected in comments and low ratings the investment staff provided in response to the 2021 survey. Trustee Mahoney worried about investment staff attrition. Trustee Mahoney testified that she began to question the executive director's leadership at the 2021 annual meeting in Kodiak and the budget workshops leading up to that meeting. According to Trustee Mahoney, the executive director's proposed budget was inflated and unrealistic, and she felt the executive director lashed out at her when Trustee Mahoney expressed her view that the budget was too high. Trustee Mahoney testified that she was also disappointed in the executive director's decision to invite a mediator to the board meeting in Kodiak to facilitate a discussion about the strategic plan implementation with the board. Trustee Mahoney had a vision that the fund would grow to a $100 billion fund and that new leadership would be needed for the fund to reach that goal. Trustee Feige was troubled by the executive director's June 18, 2021 press release as well regarding the effects of government shutdown would have on the APFC. She viewed the press release as, quote, wildly inappropriate, end quote, inaccurate, and overly political. It played a major role in her decision to vote in favor of termination. Trustee Feige also described the executive director's plan to have a mediator facilitate discussions with the trustees at the 2021 annual meeting in Kodiak as a, quote, bright line event, end quote. In Trustee Feige's view, this plan demonstrated that the executive director was not comfortable engaging directly with the board and evidence of breakdown in the relationship. Trustee Richards testified to a variety of concerns about the executive director's performance, dating back to his original term as a trustee in 2015 and 2016, and continuing through 2021. He was candid that he may have been in favor of terminating the executive director for 2018 and 2019, but the trustees at that time were not supportive of that move. Trustee Richards' concerns were wide-ranging, but his most pressing concerns during the 2021 evaluation process related to what he described as the executive director's strained relationship with the investment staff and the possibility of losing the CIO or other top investors because of that relationship. He also cited the executive director's proposed position of 15 new staff and plan to use a mediator as examples of a breakdown in the executive director's ability to communicate candidly and directly with the board. Trustee Rieger did not share the performance concerns expressed by Trustees Schutt, Mahoney, Feige, and Richards. He testified that he had a lot of confidence in the executive director and that the performance concerns raised by the other trustees could be addressed. Trustee Rieger nevertheless voted in favor of termination because he viewed the situation in which a majority of the board had lost confidence in the executive director as, quote, untenable, end quote, and believed it was therefore in the best interest of the APFC to move forward with the decision as quickly as possible. Trustee Rieger testified that the trustees in favor of termination had valid basis for their concerns in his view, though those concerns were not significant enough in Trustee Rieger's mind to justify terminating the executive director. Trustee Moran was the only trustee who voted against terminating the executive director. In his view, the executive director's performance has been exceptional, and she deserves credit as one of the key principals in achieving record returns for the APFC, as measured both against internal benchmarks and compared with other large sovereign wealth funds. Trustee Moran described these achievements as, quote, spectacular, end quote, and noted that APFC's advisors were very complimentary of the whole organization. Trustee Moran did not agree with the substantive criticisms of the executive director in the 2021 evaluation, and he maintained confidence in her leadership. However, although Trustee Moran disagreed with the substantive criticisms and the decision to terminate, he did not have concerns about how the decision was reached. In his view, the trustees who voted to terminate the executive director were acting in good faith in furtherance of what they believed was in the best interest of the APFC. In addition, a number of trustees cited comments made by Trustee Moran in executive session as confirming their inclination to move in a different direction. According to these trustees, Trustee Moran commented that the issues other trustees were raising with the executive director's leadership were part of her leadership style and were not likely to change. Collectively, the reasons expressed by the trustees for the decision to terminate the executive director supported the termination as a matter of employment law and that they were a valid exercise of the trustees' ability to terminate an at-will employee such as Ms. Rodell. A loss of confidence in the chief executive of an organization such as APFC is a sufficient legal reason under the legal standards applicable to at-will employment in Alaska. Now, the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation is enmeshed in politics by virtue of its structure and its purpose. The APFC is within the Department of Revenue, an executive branch agency. The fund's annual budget is included in the governor's budget and must be funded by legislative appropriations. The trustees are appointed by the governor, and two trustees are members of the governor's cabinet. Given this structure, protecting the independence of the fund requires vigilance and strict adherence to fiduciary duties by the trustees. The trustees all acknowledge the fiduciary standards as their compass in making related decisions. The trustees' strict compliance with their fiduciary duties of loyalty and due care protect the fund from undue political influence. The relatively recent transition from using the fund's investment returns to fund state services has had further political implications for APFC. Historically, earnings on permanent fund investments were used primarily to fund permanent fund dividends in accordance with the statutory formula. That changed in 2018 when, in the face of declining oil revenues, the state began drawing on investment returns to fund government services. The importance of the fund's financial performance has therefore changed in importance in Alaska. In addition, the Board of Trustees has adopted resolutions advocating for or supporting the adoption of specific legislative and constitutional policies. The trustees expect the executive director to advance these policy positions in front of the legislature and the executive branch. These expectations are also inherently political. The executive director testified to the political pressures inhering in the position as a result of these developments. Ms. Rodell explained that when she was hired in 2015, quote, "The focus was to generate positive returns that would, in effect, be used for the permanent fund dividend. During my time as executive director, that changed substantially in the sense that there was no change in generating returns, but there was a change in the use of the fund. The state began using the fund for state government purposes, and there was a lot of pressure placed on my position to testify to the long-term sustainability of some of those plans. There was a big focus on ensuring the sustainability of the permanent fund. That was a turn away from what historically had been the executive director role, so it raised the profile of the position," end quote. Given all of the foregoing, it is neither reasonable nor feasible to expect that the executive director can be insulated entirely from political pressure or influence, making adherence to fiduciary principles even more important. There is no direct or circumstantial evidence that the governor directed the trustees to terminate the executive director. There is no direct evidence or credible circumstantial evidence that the governor knew in advance that the executive director would be terminated. Chair Richards, Trustee Feige, and Trustee Mahoney denied under oath when asked directly if there had been any advance communications or directions from the governor regarding terminating the executive director. Non-commissioner Trustees Schutt, Rieger, and Moran also reported no contact whatsoever with the governor or his administration related to the termination of the executive director and did not perceive the other trustees to be acting at the direction or at the behest of the governor's office. The governor first learned about the termination from Trustee Feige when they were both attending a mining conference in Reno, Nevada. Trustee Feige testified that the governor reacted with surprise when she told him about the termination of the executive director.
Yes, we have a question with Representative Josephson.
Yes, it's about, through the chair, Mr. Slotty, there is, apparently, I didn't know until today, that there was a report done at the same time, concurrently, more or less, with your own report by the APFC. And in it, that this is secondhand. I haven't read the other report. But apparently, in that 16-page report, there's a reference to the governor knowing that there were issues involving E.D. Rodell, and that he was basically on notice about them. So when you conclude, and of course you weren't in Reno, Nevada, that he was surprised, did you find that credible?
Yeah, Chair, Representative Johnson, through the chair, that conclusion is based on testimony by Trustee Feige under oath at her deposition, where she specifically relayed how she just told the governor and relayed what his reaction to it.
Going back a couple pages, and I was going to ask about this a few minutes ago, but it's more apropos now because we've covered it. I personally asked through the chair, Executive Director Rodell, many times in committee, what is the Permanent Fund Corporation's position on Senate Bill 26 and overdrawing? And that's the bill that says now, originally it was 5.25%, but now 5% can be taken of the whole to fund whatever we want to fund, literally whatever we want to fund. She always consistently referred to resolutions, some of them quite old, from the board, so this would be different trustees, where the board consistently said, whatever you do in a PONB structure, make it consistent and sustainable. Relative to that context and the Kodiak meeting, and I'm sort of using my memory here, was there any discussion in any of your depositions about the dividend? Because I think it's a matter of fact that the administration would have welcomed an overdraw and probably still would welcome an overdraw to, quote, pay back, close quote, past dividends. So that's a central issue. Can you tell us what you know?
I'm going to pause there. We still had, we have Trustee Rieger's, Trustee Richards that Mr. Slotty needs to review. And the things that you're talking about are on the next page. So, if we could just, now that Mr. Slotty has kind of your thoughts, the other thing is I do see that we have a PowerPoint. Does it make sense, Mr. Slotty, to potentially use the PowerPoint even now, or do we want to wait until we have one or two more pages and then the PowerPoint will be more usable? And the only reason why I say this is that there are folks online and they don't have this copy in front of them like we do, but they can see, I believe, the screen, which may help folks online. We've got about 8 or 9 people. What are your thoughts about that?
I'm happy to do that, Chair.
Okay.
Chair, we're almost to Section 3.
Okay.
We can just hear the last couple of Chair Richards and then
just get those through documents?
Yeah, down to 8, 9, or 3.
Okay. And then let's just do that, and then I would like to start using the overhead because I believe that's going to help people. I am still reticent about until we are finished with this to post this. We're going to stick to the timeline at 5 p.m., but we can use this overhead, please. Thank you.
In regards to Chair, thank you again. In regards to Representative Dustin's question about prior contact between the governor's office and Trustee Richards, Trustee Richards did testify about several conversations with the executive branch regarding the executive director's performance. In a conversation with the governor about other matters, Trustee Richards took the opportunity to advise the governor that there were concerns about the executive director's performance. The governor responded by telling Trustee Richards that any decision regarding the executive director's performance or termination was solely the trustee's. Trustee Richards also had two conversations about the executive director's performance with Governor Dunleavy's chief of staff in the months preceding the trustee's decision to terminate. According to Trustee Richards, the chief of staff advised him to make sure that the trustees followed a lawful process and documented the basis for any decision. Trustee Richards explained that he believed it was important to give the governor notice of potentially important decisions under consideration by the trustees that could impact state government. Again, Trustees Richards, Trustees Feige, and Trustee Mahoney all denied under oath that they had communications with the governor's office regarding the decision to terminate Ms. Rodell prior to that decision being made, in terms of governor giving them direction or them giving them a heads up, like in late 2021, that was something they were considering. In light of the fund's critical importance to sustaining government services and payment of dividends to Alaska, the trustees' adoption of resolutions requiring the executive director to advocate for certain policy positions. The executive director could not avoid being drawn into political discussions and debate around the funds available for appropriations to fund the budget and the amount of the dividend. When the executive director attempted to navigate these political waters, the trustees ultimately held it against her. In some cases, trustees viewed the executive director's actions and statements as being too political, such as in the case of the press release and the tweet that we will address later. In other circumstances, the trustees faulted the executive director for not advocating APSC's policy positions forcefully enough. In both cases, the several trustees attributed the executive director's conduct as being driven by a personal agenda rather than the APSC's agenda. In light of the high stakes, and I guess in specific in response to Representative Joseph's additional question, in 2018, the trustees adopted resolutions supporting a rules-based legal framework for transfers into, out of, and between the permanent fund principal account and the earnings reserve account. The resolutions directed the executive director to support the need for a rules-based framework in front of the legislature. Ms. Rodell testified that she did so despite what she acknowledged as misgivings about the APSC advocating policy positions in front of the political branches. Some trustees perceived, fairly or not, that the executive director was not advocating forcefully enough for the positions adopted by the resolution. In light of the high stakes and politically charged operating environment for anyone serving as chief executive officer of the APFC, the need to have a fair, objective evaluation instrument that measures performance in relation to clear objectives and implementation of the strategic plan of APFC is critical to preserving the sustained performance and independence of the fund. The charter provides good and effective process for evaluating the performance of the executive director. The trustees should follow the mandate of the charter to minimize bias and improper attribution of unsupported votes.
May I have a quick comment, Chair?
Vice Chair Tuck.
Thank you. Real quickly, so the trustees should follow the mandates of the charter to minimize bias and improper attribution, but using bias and improper attribution not necessarily unlawful in terminating an at-will employee. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative, a personal experience that you directly have with someone forms your decision. And when you use the term bias, I would shift it a little bit to say that we didn't find any evidence of overt bias. There was certainly evidence that there was maybe a personality conflict between the executive director and one trustee. We're making a distinction between subjective decisions based on relevant factors for an executive board relationship. Trust and confidence in someone's leadership is inherently subjective. It could be unfairly influenced by a personality conflict. It could be unfairly influenced by a bias, but if there's facts supporting that, yes, the communications aren't good, yes, the relationship is strained, and that's been the case for some time, that would certainly support a board member's subjective conclusion that they've lost confidence in the leadership of an executive director. So the purpose of a good solid evaluation tool instrument that has objective measures is to, yes, eliminate bias, but you know, some of that is going to creep into an assessment and evaluation. So I try to minimize it, but you know, that's inherent in the process, I think.
If I may, just a quick comment. The reason I asked the question, I guess the answer is yes, but the reason I asked the question is because I can't help but to wonder that if they did follow their charter, that improvements could have been made. There's a lot of lack of communications. And when you look at a position where the permanent fund is highlighted, very highlighted in the public, there's conflict in how it should be used, how it shouldn't be used. She is the front person when coming in front of committees such as the Finance Committee, and she has to answer some tough questions without clear, concise directives. Put a person between a rock and a hard place. And you know, it's almost set bear traps out for somebody who can't help but step in. And so I really want to focus on that charter portion of it, because I think the reason why they have such a, sounds like a very well put together, strong policy for the executive director to be evaluated and to have improvements, that deviating away from that unintentionally allowed the board to make mistakes or to not see things on a performance review basis. And it sounds like to me it's between personality and performance. Those are conflicting with one another. I think that's probably the reason why we have some trustees that have hard time with decisions, because the performance can't deny. And then when you look at even outside the organization, outside the Permanent Fund Corporation, where there's been even reviews that it's one of the great places to work, that has to be attributed to the executive director, more so than any individual board member or collectively the board. So I wish that they did follow that charter a little bit more, because it may have, maybe not, prevented where we're at today. So thank you for that. Appreciate it.
I know Senator Bishop, followed by
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Under B1, under the findings, on the first paragraph, starting with given the structure protecting the independence of the fund requires vigilance and strict adherence to fiduciary duties by the trustees. The trustees all acknowledge and adhere to fiduciary standards. So I asked this question in January, and I'm going to ask it to you guys, how much fiduciary training has the trustees got since they were appointed to the board?
Through the chair, Senator Van, this is Howard Tricky. They are provided, I recall it now from the testimony, Mr. Flatty can correct me if I'm wrong, but initially when they're selected and appointed to the trustees, as a trustee, they received training on their fiduciary duties, and I believe now they do that, revisit that on an annual basis as well. So the initial onboarding as a new trustee, you know, they get the training on their fiduciary duties and standards, and then I think they have followed up with that and provide annual training as well.
And through the chair, Senator Bishop, so Mr. Tricky is correct. However, they did not receive any training on evaluation of an executive director. They did not receive any training on the use of this 360-degree survey, and particularly in 2021, they did not have any kind of outside consultant that had, you know, expertise in the area of evaluations to implement and kind of facilitate their use of that survey. In 2020, they did. They hired an outside consultant to prepare the 360-degree survey, and that outside consultant also prepared the survey results and presented them to the trustees. And Ms. Rodell testified that the 2020 evaluation was one of the first times that she actually received, in her view, perspective, helpful feedback from the annual review. So there was no training about the actual evaluation of the executive director. Thank you.
Representative Bonhold.
Yeah, I think I want to follow up a little bit on kind of a concept that the vice chair left earlier, and that was about the issue of bias. And as they went into this two-day meeting that was almost entirely an executive session, sort of summarized for
the individual reasons trustees had for making the decision, but it strikes me that the foundation going into this meeting of a lot of the discussion was exactly how efficient. Did the trustees believe that they were reviewing and receiving an objective evaluation when they received the document that had essentially what I'm going to call sort of cherry-picked comments that may have somewhat misrepresented the totality of the comments from staff?
Through the chair to Representative Funnels, the trustees gave varying weights for the survey results. Some said they looked at the scores and put more weight on the scores and that the results in the summary prepared by Trustee Mahoney than the comments. Others said they looked at comments and didn't put so much weight on the scores. So it was a varying approach to that. I think none of them kind of questioned the summary report prepared by Trustee Mahoney, largely probably because they had no kind of grounding or training in which to identify any potential issues with it. And they were not provided the raw comments. The only kind of document regarding the survey results that I received was the report, the summary report prepared by Trustee Mahoney.
Through the chair, I might supplement that response with there seemed to be sort of a cumulative effect of several things that happened in 2021 that led to discussion in executive session that focused on the extent of the trustees' consensus about having confidence in their leadership. And it started with this June 21st press release during the budget impasse between the legislature and the governor. And in August of 2021, there was a tweet that she released and sent out during a budget discussion to correct what was available under the. And then there was the September 2021 board meeting of Cody Act, where several things occurred at that meeting that were very disturbing to trustees. So those were. Those were the things they seemed to primarily focus on during their executive session discussion as things that demonstrated the inappropriate judgment, lack of judgment, and then demonstrated the ineffective communication relationships they had directly with the executive director. So my actual findings explain each of those things in their complete context, so you can get a sense of how the trustees use those. But it was those things that they seemed to focus on more during their discussion.
And we're going to take a deeper dive to each of those items here. But I can't help but comment that, just a question, did the trustees at all have any concern that they didn't follow their own charter? They were inconsistent. Do they have any self-reflection on that? And did they have any concerns that they brought it in-house and at least articulate what potentially could be perceived even political influence? And was there any concern by the trustees that only four participated versus six? Did they have any concern about that it wasn't fully participated? And that, was there any concern that the comments, not all comments were included, that only negative comments versus positive comments? Because I think collectively, would the 2021 performance evaluation had a different outcome? If everyone performed, all comments were included, if it was done by third party, and in your deposition with the six trustees, was any of that reflection or regret, anything along that line?
So, Chair, so a little bit of background on that. In from 2016 through 2021, this actually might be the appropriate time to do a little bit of the slideshow. So specifically the executive director evaluation policy, because I think this really goes to the question right here. So what I'm going to do here is basically summarize it. So the the policy is intended to, and this is from the language of the policy, to ensure that the executive director receives appropriate and useful feedback on their performance from the board on an annual basis and help develop clear and performance, meaningful performance objectives for the executive director. Policy identifies specific criteria to evaluate the executive director's performance against. That includes achievement of the goals and objectives of the ATSC, mission-specific projects and initiatives set out in the strategic plan for that fiscal year, implementation of board policies and reporting requirements, general leadership and management skills, and compliance with the executive director's charter. So the general process is that the governance committee is responsible for initiating and coordinating the annual survey and review process. So the evaluation process begins with a meeting between the vice chair and the executive director to review the existing evaluation criteria and survey questions and discuss and agree upon any changes. The vice chair is then tasked with circulating the evaluation survey to each trustee in advance of the board's fourth quarterly meeting in December. Survey is to be accompanied by the executive director's self-assessment and a copy of the board's strategic plan and budget for that year. Policy contemplates that each trustee will complete the survey and return it to a facilitator. The facilitators tabulate the survey results, present a report summarizing them to the governance committee for review prior to its submission to the full board, and the completed surveys are also then presented to the governance committee and then to the board. The board then meets in executive session to review the and discuss the results of the executive director's performance evaluation, following which the governance committee is to prepare a draft evaluation report with the executive director's self-assessment and a summary of the results and its attached as appendices. Following completion of the draft evaluation report, the board meets with the executive director to discuss the evaluation and opportunities for improvement. The board then approves the final evaluation report. The chair, vice chair, and executive director sign it, and it is placed in their personnel policy. So this is an effective evaluation process that adequately and fairly documents the performance by outlining expectations for future performance. Ideally, this process will enable the identification of underperformance in key areas while showcasing the strengths and achievements towards the organization's mission. This evaluation process would also establish the governing board's expectations, direct organizational resources in support of the leader's professional development, better enable organizational performance, and enhance communication between the board and the leader. And this evaluation policy adopts these standard HR practices for executives. It is thorough and would be ineffective if conducting an objective annual evaluation. And while the evaluation policy was essentially itself the same over the entirety of Ms. Wardell's tenure, trustees' adherence and application of the policy was not. The policy changed in different ways. Not all trustees completed and submitted the evaluation survey each year, and indeed there was only, and indeed in almost every year, or really in every year, specific mandates of the policy were not followed. They did not have governance committee meetings in which were the evaluation results were considered and then a report prepared to be submitted to the board. There's only one instance, 2018, in which the final evaluation report was actually completed, signed by the chair, the vice chair, and Ms. Rodell. So it was a good policy. The consultant we retained to look at it said it was a good policy that could generate an effective evaluation, but it simply was not followed. Now, during the depositions, we did ask the trustees about that, and they typically, I'm paraphrasing here, viewed the kind of deviations from the policy as non-material. For example, the governance committee meeting, comprised of three out of the six trustees, they felt they could essentially kind of skip that step, just go straight to the board, didn't need to have a separate committee. We can see, kind of, I think, fairly objectively, fact that not all trustees completed the evaluation survey each year as indicative of perhaps a lack of inclination to or time spent or importance placed on that evaluation survey. And indeed, several trustees testified that particularly in 2021, they either placed little or pretty much minimal weight on the survey results.
A question for you. What did your consultant say about those non-material deviations?
Our consultant's opinion was that the process is a good process and it should be followed, and that the evaluation in 2021 did not result in kind of a complete and fair evaluation of Ms. Rodell's performance.
Not a complete or fair evaluation, and that exhibit will be uploaded today at 5?
Yes, that is one of the exhibits.
On hold.
So if the board did
didn't adhere to its own policy for evaluation, what's the point of having an evaluation?
Chair, Representative Sponholz, as a lawyer, that is my general approach to it. If you have a policy, you should follow it. And again, to the point of would something different have happened in 2021, we cannot know that. But there's no way to know if that would have, if following the policy of 2021 would have resulted in a different result. I can say that, you know, if the policy had followed since 2015 or 2016 and consistently throughout, it might have resulted in a different result because it may have provided that useful feedback that Ms. Rodell identified in 2021 to have permitted her to address the concerns raised by the board ultimately in 2021.
Isn't it reasonable for an executive director to expect that the board would adhere to the policy if they would be evaluated?
Through the chair, Representative Sponholz, I would say yes. I will note that no trustee kind of objected, nor did Ms. Rodell object to the policy, like formally try to require a governance committee, formally require certain steps. I don't know if that's indicative of a conscious decision or just viewing it as paperwork as opposed to something substantive that should be followed.
Is it illegal to not adhere to a policy that's in a governing document?
Through the chair, Representative Sponholz, no, the board has the ability to change its policies. It can do so either formally or informally. It is probably not a good practice in terms of evaluating an executive leader, and they should follow it. But I would not frame it as illegal.
They had the ability to change the policy, but they never did. They just chose to ignore the policy and proceed for lack of compliance.
Through the chair, Representative Sponholz, I think that it would be probably accurate to say that they did not follow the policy. They did not adopt any formal motion or formal amendment to the policy. Oftentimes, a board will just, you know, kind of collectively decide to go follow a particular disregarded policy in one instance. It's typically not good corporate governance. It's typically advised against. But no, you're right. They did not actually amend the policy to say this is, or have a formal motion to say we are deviating from the policy in this particular year or this particular instance.
If I may, Senator, running off in response to the questions about the policy and practice, your question, Senator Von der Leff, was did the board reflect on this and, you know, acknowledge that they should have done it differently or regret it not having done it differently? And there's an issue about the consistency of the board because some of them didn't have the history, but Chair Richards recognized and stated in response to that kind of question, which we asked all of them, that he recognized that by changing the evaluation over the years, the feedback that the executive director received was inconsistent. So he acknowledged that their feedback was inconsistent by virtue of changing the evaluation tool and instrument as they did almost each year until 2020. And the second thing that, since we're on this, that I think is worth pointing out, and we addressed this report, that there was a big disconnect between what the executive director thought the board expected of her and what the board in fact was expecting of her. And I think that's a result of deviating from following a standard evaluation process where there's consistent feedback. And the most striking thing that stands out is that the executive director felt that she was being evaluated based on the performance of the fund and that the performance of the fund reflected on her effective leadership of the organization. And most of the trustees placed little to no weight on the performance of the fund in terms of crediting the executive director for that performance. They saw it as a product of the investment team and the superior results and the of the fund's performance were credit to the investment team and not any single individual, and that she had no, you know, was not directly responsible for that kind of performance. So she thought she should be evaluated on that basis and credited with it, and most of the board did not.
Thank you. I do have Andy, Representative Josephson, followed by Senator Bishop. I do want to make a comment, though. Chair Richards acknowledged the inconsistency, but has he taken any responsibility? And she's been the one that's there the whole time. Somewhat rhetorical. The question that I do have is, who hires the investment team?
Under the executive director's charter, the executive director is generally in charge of identifying the investment staff. The board of trustees will have kind of final say over some of the senior executives on the investment staff, like CIO, for example. But in general, and actually I'll refer to the, it's exhibit one, it's the policies and specifically the executive director's charter. In regards to investments, it lays out as the investment, the executive director's duties is to develop and recommend to the board an investment policy, including the board's overall investment philosophy and mechanism for monitoring and managing investment risk, the long-term or strategic asset allocation of the fund in terms of the proportion of total assets to be invested, and to implement all investment policies and strategies as approved by the board. And she's also to direct the appropriate financial and operational controls and procedures are put in place to safeguard the assets of the fund.
Please repeat. Who is this responsible?
This is the executive director charter.
The
responsibilities to which she is placed in charge of pursuant to the policies adopted by the trustees.
Thank you. All right. So we have Representative Josephson.
Through the chair, am I right that in the subject of an employee, terminated employee, at will employee, bring in action, that notwithstanding being at-will employees, people have prevailed, plaintiffs have prevailed and won damages.
Oh, absolutely correct. Through the chair, this is Howard Trigge speaking. Yes.
So when your consultant concludes that Ms. Rudell did, quote, not complete, did not receive a complete and fair evaluation, that's evidence that could be presented to a jury, theoretically, right? On the question of objectivity of termination.
Through the chair, yes, it is, but then they would also, in consideration of all the evidence that would be presented in that case in this context, the board can explain reasons other than those as the basis for their decision. And as I said earlier in response to your questions, when we deposed them on those reasons and then looked at all the direct and circumstantial evidence that they cited that supported those reasons, we did not find that any of those reasons were false or pretextual in any way.
To the chair, except that, Mr. Trigge, you said that some of the trustees did rely on the evaluations for their foundation as to why to terminate. And some did, like Mr. Rieger thing. So if there was a faulty evaluation and it led to part of the reason for termination, that's a problem for the board, isn't it?
Through the chair, yes, but it's one, I mean, in the context of the question of a prima facie case for a breach of the covenant of good faith and fair dealing. Yes, that's a fact that would be an unfavorable fact for the board, but it's just one fact among others. And when I say among others, they have reasons that are sufficient reasons when you're talking about the most senior executive in an organization, and they did have factual support for those reasons. Now, it's difficult in this case because when you look at, well, what was the consensus reason was really lack of confidence. And you would expect that had they gone through an evaluation process and used the evaluation tool, that they would have had the same, the consensus was lack of confidence. They all had an independent and separate reason for lack of confidence. If you used an objective process and evaluation tool, they would likely have all had the same reason or sympathy. Does that make sense?
So we have one more question, then I do have in the queue, Senator Bishop, followed by Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I think since we're roughly on page 13, I think this is appropriate. And it's about the top of 13 where you've written that some trustees perceived fairly or not that the director was not advocating forcefully enough for the positions adopted by resolution. Did they tell you through the chair which positions she was not forceful enough about? Because I think the our archives, for lack of a better word, would show over and over that she was forceful about the rules-based framework. She was completely forceful. And so if they said, well, you weren't forceful enough about that, that just doesn't pass the smell test, for lack of a better word.
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, the general testimony was, again, paraphrasing, was it wasn't this specific issue. It was more of a general sense. They just didn't feel what they framed as her agenda, which was never specifically identified as to what they believe her specific agenda was, other than kind of broad kind of general terms, was different than the Board of Trustees' agenda. I think Trustee Richards did testify that she did support the resolution, the POMB approach, and that he did not have an issue with her support of that. It was more kind of the agenda was focused on that the issues that they identified as her having a potentially different agenda than the board was, for example, potentially the there was a proposal to have a APFC office in Anchorage. That was, for example, Trustee Richards identified kind of a general agenda, I think, regarding the incentive compensation for the investment officials, kind of a general approach towards what role would APFC to take with regards to the state government.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So it sounds like they're mostly accumulation of distrust or not being able to get along happened in the last half of 2021. And so it started off, I believe, was a tweet or a press release, or was a press release and then a tweet. But were those press releases inconsistent with any prior press releases that she has ever released?
Well, through the chair, Representative Clark, I think it's all can go through that. The press release that was identified by at least two trustees as being a significant event.
Okay, and then to piggyback on the previous dialogue on her role over the CIOs. So once they're hired, does she have the ability to discipline or to reward the CIOs?
Representative Tuck, through the chair, in general, the executive director is responsible for managing the day-to-day operations of the APFC. The executive director will select and employ the staff necessary to manage APFC and develop appropriate staff training and development programs, and then recommend appropriate policies. And the executive director will determine the appropriate level of compensation for staff within the benefits and compensation policy approved by the board. So I think generally the answer would be yes. I think if you're talking about the CIO, it seems to be an issue that would probably be brought in front of the trustees, not pursuant to any specific policy that's identified in the governance charters, but rather by as a matter of practice.
And if I may, there was one CIO that left, but it was never stated the reason why the CIO had left. Did we ever determine the reason?
Representative Tuck, through the chair, that was not a topic of our investigation. I believe that Trustee Richards did testify that one of his concerns was that about losing their current CIO. I think he made reference to something along the lines of, like, they lost a prior CIO or something like that. But it was not a focus of our investigation. We do not know why. He talked about Mr. Reed. I have that name right, why he left. But I do know that several trustees testified that they were concerned about the relationship between Ms. Rodell and the current CIO, Marcus Frampton, and that they wanted to avoid losing Mr. Frampton. Ms. Rodell testified that she perceived her relationship with Mr. Frampton, although it started off on a relatively rocky basis, had been improved significantly since then.
But the, through the chair, the trustee with the longest tenure of service was Trustee Richards, and his testimony does say that the prior CIO, Russell E., left because of a strained relationship with the executive director. So he perceived it. And I think that in his mind, I don't want to sound like I'm defending or advocating any decisions here, I'm trying to present the facts, was part of his, connected to his reasoning that the low scores with the investment staff placed, created the risk that the corporation could lose some of its top investment talent. That was his thinking. I'm trying to present to you what his thinking was as he explained it in response to our question from the deposition.
And then through the chair, that they were improved. I mean, it sounded like that there towards the end, that the relationship, at least the relationship between the CIO and Ms. Rodell had been improving. But let me move on from that real quick. So sounds like that June, August, and then September, there's a Kodiak board meeting. And at that meeting was when she came in with a facilitator to help develop the strategic plan. Is that correct?
Correct.
So I know, serving on the Anchorage School District School Board, that we often have a facilitator with us when we came up with our strategic plan for the next year. Most of the, if I remember correctly, the superintendent had a list of people, and then the board decided who we would have collectively. However, in this situation, it sounded like that she brought someone on board without notification of the other board members. Is that correct, or did the board part of that decision?
Let's give you the full factual context, and then you may have follow-up questions.
That sounds great. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you. So I think what we're going to go in now is to do a deeper dive on, it looks like, looking on page 12, you talked about briefly a press release, the tweet, and a Kodiak meeting. Is that correct?
Yes, sir. So we're going to start with the 2021 press release regarding the government shutdown, potential government shutdown. This was a press release that was identified by some trustees as a significant event in their evaluation of Ms. Rodell's performance. So in June of 2021, the deadline for the state to pass a budget without interrupting government services was approaching, and a budget impasse was raising the specter of a government shutdown. On June 18th, 2021, the executive director issued a press release explaining the negative consequences of a shutdown would have on APFC's operations and investments. The press release raised the possibility that APF staff would be furloughed and not be able to monitor investments during any shutdown. Several trustees testified that they viewed the executive director's June 18, 2021 press release as overtly and improperly political and unnecessarily drew APFC into a dispute between the executive and legislative branches. Ms. Rodell did not run the press release by the other trustees or any trustees prior to issuing. Trustee Feige testified that the press release was, quote, wildly inappropriate, quote, absolutely out of bounds, quote, and that she was, quote, absolutely furious. Trustee Schutt viewed the press release as kind of an empty and inaccurate threat, and to, quote, to use that lever in a public debate was a very poor choice and over the line, end quote. In his view, it was a, quote, serious problem, end quote, that undermined the credibility of the fund and a decision that should have been cleared in advance with the board. Trustee Moran testified that nobody expressed any concerns to him about the press release until October of that year. He acknowledged that the press release was perceived by some as a criticism of either the legislature or the executive branch, but he viewed it as just a statement of the issues. The executive director stated that she felt she had the authority to issue press releases like this within her role as spokesperson for the APFC under the charter. And Ms. Rodell and Trustee Moran issued a joint joint letter to the legislature and administration 3 days later regarding the potential impact of a government shutdown at APFC that did not generate a similar objection from other trustees. And finally, the 2021 press release was materially similar to a press release issued by Ms. Rodell in 2017. I have here on the screen the two press releases that are also included in our exhibits. There are some differences, but there is a lot of the same thing. So the other kind of event in 2021 was the tweet. So this is a second public statement by the executive director that some trustees viewed as too political, which was a tweet sent on August 20th, 2021. On that date, Governor Dunleavy's OMB director, Neil Steininger, was giving a budget presentation to the House Finance Committee. The committee asked him what the balance of the earnings reserve account would be if the legislature adopted the governor's proposed appropriation bill. He did not have that figure readily available. The executive director, who was watching the presentation remotely, published the following tweet. As of June 30th, the ERA has an uncommitted balance of $9.3 billion, of which the governor's appropriation bill would use $3 billion, leaving the balance of $6.3 billion for future appropriations. Trustee Richards characterized the tweet as, quote, very political, unprofessional, backhanded critique of the governor, end quote. A member of the governor's staff, Brandon Persinski, reached out to Commissioner Mahoney to express the administration's displeasure with the tweet. Commissioner Mahoney did not personally find the tweet problematic for her testimony and trusted that the executive director's numbers were correct. She did convey the administration's concerns to the executive director and advised her to be, quote, mindful, end quote, of how her public statements could be perceived. The executive director characterized the conversation differently. According to her deposition testimony, Trustee Mahoney called Ms. Rodell more than once to, quote, warn her to watch her back. Ms. Rodell offered to tender her resignation, but Trustee Mahoney told her that was not necessary.
Yes.
Was it because she tweeted, or is there content that I missed? Because it sounded like to me she was just giving the information that was asked. It didn't seem like any sort of backhanded critique.
I think some, Chair, some of the trustees, or at least Trustee Richards, had questions about the accuracy of the numbers, given it seems like there was a potentially rather esoteric method of calculating how much was remaining, how much would be remaining in the earnings reserve account after the appropriations, taking into account realized and unrealized gains. So there was, some people, potentially in the administration, had some concerns over the accuracy, but that was not the main focus of their ire. It was issuance of the tweet at all. They viewed it as inserting the APFC into a political issue.
Madam Chair?
Mm-hmm.
Stating factual numbers, it sounded like she wasn't wrong in her numbers. I think they said that she was correct. Mahoney recognized that she was correct, right?
Representative Huck, through the chair, no one testified that they believed that the numbers were inaccurate.
Okay, so I think that what the board needs to do is come up with a policy that the executive director is not allowed to tweet, because I can't connect those dots of what their conclusions were. So I think that the fact that she tweeted is a problem. I can understand that. What she tweeted, I don't see as a problem. And I don't know how anyone can be offended when she was just stating the facts of
if I could, Senator Vanya, they seemed to feel that the problem was injecting herself into the debate when the legislature had not requested updated information. The trustees seemed to be that the executive director should remain scrupulously neutral and not inject the fund or her own position into debates without a request for the information from the legislature. So they viewed it as following on in the context of the June 21st press release of her again crossing a line that hadn't been clearly drawn, but crossing a line in their mind, but she was now injecting the fund more directly into the politics of the budget process than the fund needed to be.
Representative Josephson?
As to, through the chair, as to both these issues, and this isn't a question, but I'd like to make a little record if I could. When we've come close to a budget, we've had a budget impasse and come close to a shutdown, the administration, both Walker and Dunleavy administrations, has asked for commissioners, for example, to say, these are the ramifications. And the implication is, whoever is causing this near shutdown, get your house in order, because this is what's going to happen. That's as to the press release. As to the tweet, the homepage, because I look at it all the time, the first page of the homepage reflects the realized and unrealized gains and the available cash in the ERA. It's just right there. So I don't, and she gets asked that daily in committee. So every day she testifies. So I'm confused about that. Thank you.
It does seem that there's slightly a bit of excessive ire placed on pretty benign documents and the tweet. And I just am curious whether the board was trying to find a place to hang their hat. That's all they can come up with.
Well, Chair, at this time we've moved to the 2021 committee meeting in Kodiak. That's something that Representative Puck mentioned, and I think that also was referenced by several trustees when explaining why they chose to terminate Ms. Riddle's employment. So the Board of Trustees held its 2021 annual meeting in Kodiak. Several trustees pointed to events that part of this meeting as influencing their decision to terminate Ms. Rodell. Several trustees recounted a tense exchange between Executive Director and Trustee Mahoney at that meeting in Kodiak, describing Ms. Rodell as having verbally attacked Trustee Mahoney or that Ms. Rodell lashed out at Trustee Mahoney. The Executive Director acknowledged she had contentious interactions with Trustee Mahoney related to the fiscal year 2023 budget proposal at the 2021 annual meeting and the budget workshops that preceded it, and in an exchange that occurred off the record during a break. But she denied accusing Trustee Mahoney of breaching her fiduciary duties, and she denied engaging in conduct that could be reasonably characterized as an attack. Neither the minutes of the 2021 annual meeting nor the video recording of that meeting available on ACFC's public-facing website contain an exchange between the Executive Director and Trustee Mahoney that could be reasonably characterized as an attack or lashing out. This does not preclude the possibility that the exchange occurred off the record, or perhaps at a different meeting, for example, at one of the budget workshops. But there is no evidence to substantiate testimony that such an exchange occurred on the record at the annual meeting. Another example that the trustees pointed to as evidence of a disconnect in the relationship with the executive director was the executive director invited an executive leadership coach named Al Balea, with whom she had worked with in 2019, to facilitate a discussion with the trustees at that Kodiak meeting about creating alignment between the board's current priorities and the priorities officially adopted in the board's five-year strategic plan and the strategic planning and budgeting policy. The executive director explained that her purpose in inviting the facilitator was to tease out the trustees' collective vision for APSC going forward, i.e., did they envision it as a large investment management company or something more streamlined? The executive director's plan to have a third-party facilitate a public discussion with trustees about the alignment of the strategic priorities caught most of the trustees by surprise. Although the board packet each trustee received prior to the meeting stated that, quote, Al Balea will facilitate a conversation of creating alignment of the strategic plan priorities with trustees, APFC staff, and APFC stakeholders, end quote, the agenda item for the discussion stated only, quote, alignment of strategic plan, end quote, as presented by Angela Rodell, CEO. The executive director had vetted the idea with then Chair Moran, but the other trustees were not aware of it. Several trustees testified that they viewed Ms. Rodell's decision to bring Mr. Balea to the Kodiak meeting without vetting the idea with the board as a whole, first, was an example or indication of Ms. Rodell's reluctance to meaningfully engage with the board and reflected a problem with the relationship between the executive director and the board, such that the executive director felt a need for a mediator to facilitate difficult discussions. And at that September 21 Kodiak board meeting, I think that's the point of the agenda, Mr. Balea was introduced. Trustees, essentially, several of the trustees questioned why he was there, what was the purpose, and they did not proceed. They thanked Mr. Balea for coming and then dismissed him and went on to the next agenda item. And several of them testified that this was an embarrassing event. The trustee Feige referred to it as a bright line event end quote, that substantially, or at least materially, influenced her decision to vote in favor of termination.
So, thank you. You stated that Chair Bill Moran at the time was aware of this action as Angela Rovell ran it past him, and he, assuming, and gave his approval because it was included in the board packet. Is that correct?
Chair, yes.
Was there any reaccountment by either Ms. Rovell or Mr. Moran himself about defending that decision to the rest of the board prior to terminating the mediator and sending him home?
Not at that meeting, no. It was not reflected in the minutes or in the video case.
So that being said, one last finer point. You did say it was not on the agenda, but yes, it was in the meeting packet that board trustees received prior to the meeting. 2 days prior, 1 day prior, how long prior?
My apologies, Chair. I'm not aware of how long they had that board packet prior to the meeting, but there was at least a reference to it in that board packet.
Okay. Any further questions on this? No. You stated that you did listen to the full Kodiak recorded hearing. Is that correct?
Yes, I watched all 2 days.
Oof. Can you make any comment on anything that jumped out at you in light of all the depositions that you've taken?
There was a discussion over the budget. The budget was presented by Ms. Rodell. Trustee Mahoney made a motion to reduce the budget, the number of personnel that were included in the proposed budget. I think it was 5 investment personnel and 2 operational staff. She made a motion to remove that. There was some discussion between Trustee Mahoney and Ms. Rodell and other trustees. We did, as we stated before, based on what we saw in that meeting, those discussions appeared to be professional. The comments appeared to be professional. We did not see anything that was unprofessional in the video. And Trustee Mahoney's motion was ultimately defeated, and the budget was passed as submitted. Throughout the course of the meeting, there was substantial discussions and presentations about different analysis and risk factors, et cetera. And again, other than the event with Mr. Bollea, which definitely did seem to be an uncomfortable event for all involved, we did not see any other types of what would be characterized as a quote-unquote attack or unprofessional conduct by any party.
So the question that I have for you, I think you stated earlier that there was a concern about Ms. Rodell not following the collective APSC's board's vision. Is that vision generally articulated in resolutions that they pass?
Chair, yes. The board of trustees adopts resolutions, and then the executive director is asked to advocate for those resolutions. And Trustee Richards did testify that she did advocate for the resolutions passed by the board. The disconnect between the quote-unquote agenda of Ms. Rodell and the trustees was never clearly identified during the deposition testimony.
Thank you. I'd like to zero in on that. This committee has seen all the resolutions. We saw that prior meetings, I think, this spring. I've read them all. I have not seen anything inconsistent with Ms. Rovell's behavior publicly with the board resolutions. And you just stated that there was not, and that you could not find in your depositions, a link between the claim of Ms. Rovell not following the board's directive with the resolutions that have been passed by this board. Is that correct? Can you expand on that? Do you have enough information to expand on that?
So I'll use one specific example. So one of the examples that was identified as kind of a disconnect between kind of goals or objectives of the board and Ms. Rodell was the analysis of the cost of opening an office for APSC in Anchorage. That was, for example, identified by Trustee Richards as one of the kind of disconnects that he viewed between Ms. Rodell and the board. So the 5-year strategic plan adopted by the board called for the executive director to investigate the feasibility of APSC opening an office in Anchorage. Trustee Richards believed that the executive director, quote, went out of her way to make it look a little more expensive and throw a little cold water on it, end quote. The executive director acknowledged in her deposition that she thought opening an Anchorage office was a bad idea and would be a waste of APFC resources. In her view, APFC would have a lucky been better served by opening an office, quote, in places you are making a lot of investments, end quote, like New York, Chicago, Nashville, or Toronto, and having two offices in Alaska felt like a waste of money. Ms. Riddell testified that she directed her staff to prepare a cost analysis. She also testified that she told her staff she disagreed with opening an Anchorage office, but did not suggest that they structure the cost analysis in a way to make it seem more expensive than it really was. The executive director testified that she reviewed the cost analysis, but did not make any revisions before providing it to the board. The board eventually did not go forward with opening an Anchorage office. No other trustee believed the executive director manipulated the cost analysis, and no evidence was provided that substantiated that conclusion.
Thank you. And the board does have the flexibility, if they so chose, to hire an independent real estate firm, for example, to figure out what the costs are per square foot. I think the interpretation comes is, what does it cost to fly back and forth? How often do you fly back and forth? How do you manage two offices? I don't know if Ms. Riddell was asked to contemplate that, but easily, if it's just simply real estate, there's many ways to get that answer.
Sure, that is correct. And just to further follow up, to provide a little more context again on this disconnect between the agenda of the perceived agenda of the chair or the trustees and Ms. Riddell. You know, one of the things that we did find in our deposition testimony or investigation was that this tension, perceived tension between Ms. Riddell and the trustees, was a primary motivating factor besides their decision to terminate Ms. Riddell's employment. For example, in the 2021 evaluation reports, there were comments along the lines of, quote, the director's relationship with the board is soured, end quote. Quote, information that comes to the board is controlled and manipulated, or goals are sometimes ignored or even undermined, end quote. These allegations were not accompanied by any actual examples of conduct the evaluator viewed as problematic. When asked about under oath about tensions in the executive director's relationship with the board, few trustees would endorse the idea that the executive director tried to manipulate the board, withhold or control information, or pursue her own agenda. Nevertheless, tension between the executive director and certain trustees was real. The tension was observable even to some APFC staff who commented in 2021 that, quote, CEO is at odds with the board, end quote, and, quote, the dynamic between CEO and the board appears difficult, end quote, the board needs to empower the CEO, end quote. The executive director herself testified that while her relationship with the trustees really improved in early 2020, by September 2021, quote, it felt like it fell all apart, and, quote, all felt starting September 1st to go off the rails, end quote. Most trustees agreed that by the time of her evaluation in December of 2021, the executive director's relationship with at least certain trustees was strained, and that strain likely impacted her relationship with the board as a whole.
Thank you. I am hearing again and again that the board has claimed assertions of conflict, but they were unable to provide concrete evidence other than a tweet and a press release. We discussed those with Kodiak. Is this a problem that people can make a verbal assertion and then can't back it up? Or you can do that all day long?
Chair, in regards to a corporate kind of board of directors and their relationship with the CEO, it's a relationship that will be inherently impacted by their personal interactions and whatever their personalities mesh or do not mesh, et cetera. The purpose of the objective evaluation policy included in the charter is to remove those personal kind of subjective interactions, those personal subjective and the considerations from the evaluation process to hopefully provide a full and fair, complete evaluation of their actual performance of the executive director as measured against the Permanent Fund Corporation's performance. And when you don't follow that policy, you can run the risk of having your decision being influenced and motivated more by your personal subjective interactions with an individual rather than their objective performance. That is not good corporate governance. That is, in my view, generally not the best way to manage a CEO or to provide a fair opportunity to the CEO. However, it is within the trustee's kind of ambit of authority to do so. Even under the implied covenant of good faith and fair dealing in the employment context, a personality conflict is a reason, a justifiable reason for terminating an employee. And when you're at the CEO level, as Trustee Schutt explained, sometimes when the CEO's relationship with the board is soured, kind of regardless of the cause of who is quote unquote at fault, it is sometimes in the best interest of the corporation or the entity to move forward in a new direction rather than trying to divert resources and time to try to fix the problem, to fix the relationship. That is not to say that, again, that the policy, the process followed by the KPFC trustees in this case was followed their charter or was reflected best practices or good human resources practices, but just trying to give context there for that in a relationship there at the highest level.
I appreciate that. Thank you. We can take a pause here and reassess and where we want to go forward. We can talk about it right now on the record, or we can take a bathroom break.
You opened the door, so here we go.
All right, let's go.
I'm going to summarize this whole thing. We still got 2 hours to go. So, in your professional opinion, has the board taken any lessons learned from this termination to be prospectively going forward to have a good work environment for a prospective new CEO that wants to come in to be objective, or are we still going to continue to be subject to terminations?
Through the chair, Senator Bishop, first of all, I don't have a personal opinion. What I'm going to respond to is what the facts are and the evidence was that we developed through our deposition, and I think your question may well be one that you would have to direct to the trustees. But we asked each of the trustees, looking back at what occurred, is there anything you would do differently? And the response uniformly was, no, I can't think of anything we should have done differently. Anytime you have a relationship that is broken down at the level at which this relationship broke down, it's messy, and there's no way to work through this other than to just make the decision and work through it. So now, having said that, we're lawyers. We're asking them questions in an adversarial proceeding. I think there were somewhat defenses in response to that question, but when we asked, what would you do differently? Now, did you learn essentially any lessons from this that would guide what you would do differently? No one had an answer to that question. In fairness, they may not have thought about it in advance of the deposition, but we did not get any responses or testimony that indicated, yes, we're revisiting what our charter provides with regard to how we evaluate and how we evaluation process. So I hope that answers your question.
Thank you. It's just, for me, as one member of this committee, it's just, I would want to make sure that we have our plan and protocol in place to hire best of the best, because this is our nest egg to do what Wally Hickel wanted it, I mean, Governor Hammond wanted it to do, to keep pumping oil and money into the treasury long after the oil field is gone away. And I believe the trustees do too. I'm not implying that, but I, as one person, want to make sure that we are able to do that, to have a good environment where people want to come from the highest calibers of finance.
All right, so we're going to take a quick at ease, okay? At ease. it is about 3:20 p.m. and we've been here for a little over a couple hours. We've gone through the bulk of the context of this report. Do committee members have any specific areas they'd like to drill down on at this time? One question that I want to ask Mr. Schlotty, if at that September 2021 permanent funds board meeting, can you describe the timeline of the agenda that day? Did the conversation about the consultants happen before or after the budget conversation that was a little bit heated?
Chair, Senator Representative Sponholz, the budget presentation was for the agenda at 10:30 a.m., and then the proposed kind of discussion about the strategic planning session plan with the mediator was scheduled for 1 p.m. that same day.
Thank you. And if I remember correctly, Chair, indulge me for a second here. If I remember correctly, the comments around the budget that day included the staff were going to add 7 new positions, and there were some a motion to set the budget by 7 positions, and it was contextualized by saying that it would make sense for the permanent fund, it made sense for the permanent fund essentially to fill the same kind of team that Alaskans were feeling with a reduction in the permanent fund dividend amount, which actually the executive director has had no authority to determine that that's an entire legislative decision. Is that what the reviewing the tape of that meeting reflected?
So the proposal, through the chair, Representative Funnels. So the proposal was the budget included, I believe, 5 additional investment staff and 2 operational staff. And the motion was to reduce, to not remove the existing staff, staff of the APFC, but rather reduce the number of additional positions being added. One of the points being made was that, yes, that the government was trying to cut costs across the board. And that they didn't feel that it was appropriate to add on additional staff. That motion was defeated, and the budget was approved as presented.
All right, thanks for clarifying. Representative Justison.
Through the chair, Mr. Schlotty, I'm coming back to this issue I've raised a couple times about any differences of opinion that may have come up in depositions or in your research about the overdrawing of the earnings reserve. The first thing is, I think the word overdraw cannot be a charged or an embellished word because there's a law that says we can't do it. The legislature is aware the courts would let us do it because of the Wilikowski decision, even though that was on a different set of facts. But they would surely say we're the appropriators and can do it. That is overdraw. The administration around this time, because I had a rare meeting with the Commissioner of Revenue in the governor's conference room, was seeking an ad hoc draw called a bridge draw of several billion dollars. And it was very troublesome to a number of Republicans and a number of Democrats and independents because the perception was, we'll just do this one time, it'll be okay. And then, you know, we're doing so beautifully with our realized gains and cuts, and that all boats will float. Look at our chart running into the 2030s. Everything is going to be great and will be fully solvent. Was there any discussion about that? And the reason I ask is, it's hard to fathom any Board of Trustees reversing course on these important resolutions. Not just the 2018 resolution, but I remember Ms. Rodell telling me there were resolutions dating back to the aughts and maybe even the late 90s where the board said, whatever you do with an endowment structure, make it rules-based and consistent. And it would be unthinkable for a board to say, nah, we can be whimsical about our draws. Just be arbitrary and capricious about them. So where I'm going with this is, the very issue that has infected state politics, the dividend, I believe, was an undercurrent of all of these things? And was there any findings you made or any evidence of my belief?
Representative Josephson, through the chair, we asked all the trustees during their depositions if the governor's agenda or issues regarding draws from the permanent fund, ad hoc draws or otherwise, were a topic of discussion during the executive director's evaluation during the executive session. They all denied under oath that that was ever raised or addressed. So in regards to the 2021 evaluation and also the decision, they all testified that that was not a discussion point or a subject matter that influenced their decision.
Through the chair, could I add that at the time they would have had the executive session, Representative Josephson, that was a closed secret, right, you know, from their perspective, private session, which no one ever would be able to inquire into. So had they been pushing or discussing that matter at that executive session, which they would not have expected to ever have to testify about or have seen that light of day, and not told us in response to those questions that it was discussed, we would have had six witnesses under oath who had not testified truthfully. So they never expected those discussions to be in the light of day. So had they believed that, had they thought that that was a factor or should be a factor, and openly discussed it, we would have discovered it. But they under oath testified that no such discussion ever occurred, or that ever a motivating factor in their decision.
So, thank you. Did Commissioner Mahoney ever discuss or reference the time at a meeting, and I believe it was in 2021 at some point, that she hired an outside consultant to come in to run, I think it was she who was hired, scenarios on ad hoc draws and how that would affect the fund? And I know this because I saw the slide deck. I don't have it in front of me. But I do know at one point the board did consider the implications, as did the Senate Finance Committee, as did perhaps the House Finance Committee. I don't know. But I know the Senate Finance Committee did. And I do know that the board hired their own to do their own analysis on ad hoc law.
Sure. At the September 2021 Kodiak board meeting, there was a presentation that included kind of an analysis of what would happen if you took an ad hoc draw out. What would be the kind of the reallocation of the assets? But the next step, if you took the money out, how would that impact the asset allocation, or what would you need to do to rebalance the fund? If I'm recalling correctly, there was some discussions with Ms. Rodell after that, over which some trustees kind of questioned how that kind of analysis was established in terms of, is it assumed kind of a withdrawal all at once as opposed to over time? And some trustees believe that to be as kind of a overstating the impact of the draw. If you took it over time, you can mitigate that asset allocation issue versus taking it all at once. And that was the one instance, I believe, in which people that we viewed, at least at the Kodiak meeting, and then in discussions with Ms. Rodell and others, as that was an issue that was raised. But it was just, in terms of, under oath, when they were asked, what were the basis for why you terminated Ms. Rodell, what were the subject matters of discussion at the executive session, that issue did not have come up.
Thank you. So one question that I do have is, was it ever discussed, because it was, I believe, unusual to have the vice chair be a governor's appointee or employee. I believe in the history of the fund, there's never been a commissioner or any government, every governor employee serving as vice chair. The vice chair is the position that does the evaluation of the executive director. And I think there was, talking to previous executive directors, that there was, I don't know if it's in their charter, but an inherent understanding of the appropriateness of the political implications, perceived or otherwise, of having a governor's appointee act as vice chair that also does the evaluation. I see
see on page 58, you have the summary of the consultant's report on evaluation procedures. You've mentioned earlier that the 2021 evaluation had some weaknesses, which this consultant points out. Did the consultant ever ponder on the vice chair's position?
In regards to, Chair, in regards to specifically as to the vice chair or not, I don't think that that influenced the review or analysis of the actual evaluation policy that was, that should have been provided and that all of them that was actually followed. In regards to, were there concerns, I think Ms. Rodell expressed potentially in her interview that she had concerns over the fact that it was a commissioner rather than a non-commissioner appointee to serve as vice chair. I don't know that we ever did specifically identified that had ever happened in the past. I know that Linda Mishroda did raise that as a issue or as a concern.
Through the chair, my recollection is just slightly, like two heads are better than one on this, is that the practice had been that commissioners did not get appointed to the vice chair position, and there was some discussion at the September Kodiak meeting where Ms. Rodell was perceived as interfering with the board election of the vice chair or appointment of the vice chair by Chair Richards, based on some conversation he had had with Mr. Moran, that the history had been that the commissioners did not serve in that vice chair position, but there isn't anything in the charter bylaws that I recall that would preclude that. And then I worked most directly with our consultants, and I didn't ask her specifically the question you asked about whether the role of the vice chair was as a commissioner was a factor in how the evaluation issues should be handled.
Through the chair, for either Mr. Trickey or Mr. Slotty, I'm reviewing an article from KTOO at a critical moment in this history. It's from October 3rd of last year, so that tells me that indeed that's very critical. The author is Andrew Kitchenman, who I think is a well-trusted journalist, and he talks about a dispute over staff pay. One of the things that's interesting is in the article, Ms. Rodell, I read this speedily, but she seems to be defending the need for incentive pay. And that would suggest that she's trying to hold on to employees, not make their lives more challenging, but to improve their lives. Ms. Mahoney, the commissioner, opposes because she says the dividends are too small. That is, there's an argument. I'm not saying there's no argument on her side, but effectively what she's saying is we're not paying a full statutory dividend, therefore we shouldn't give these incentives. And at issue is hundreds of thousands of dollars in the Permanent Fund Corporation's budget. This article goes on and talks about, and if I can read just a couple sentences, quoting toward the end of the article, quote, Dunleavy has proposed drawing an additional $3 billion beyond the amount recommended by the board, which would allow the state to pay for both the budget and higher dividends over the next few years. The majority of lawmakers in both chambers have been concerned that spending more than planned would threaten the future of the Permanent Fund's earnings reserve. It then notes, by the way, that during Rodell's tenure, that the fund grew $30 billion. But again, I think you've answered this, but the context at this critical moment is pay to employees, the permanent fund, incentive pay, the dividend. This is the context. This is 2 months before her termination. You didn't get anything in your facts that might relate to those issues?
So, Chair, Representative Joseph, in regards to the incentive compensation, that was an issue that was discussed by a variety of trustees in our depositions and with Ms. Rodell. So generally speaking, so of course the budgetary process is, if Ms. Rodell would prepare a proposed budget for the APFC, if we present it to the trustees, they would approve it. That would include incentive compensation. That would then go to the governor. The governor's office would review it. And then whatever the governor's office approved, that would get submitted to the legislature. Legislature reviews it, makes changes, approves, and that's ultimately, of course, the product that the budget that APFC has. Incentive compensation is included through there. And after they passed incentive compensation, you know, the amount budgeted for it was less than what would have been employees to operate our investment staff would have been otherwise entitled to under the kind of strict terms of the incentive compensation policy adopted by the trustees. So our investment staff received a portion of the bonus that they would otherwise have received because that was only what was appropriated. And that certainly, according to Ms. Rodell, and what we can see from the survey comments, caused tension with the investment staff. It is, as you know, also an issue that is outside of Ms. Rodell's control because it goes through so many processes. And there was some discussions between Ms. Rodell and the trustees over, you know, would you include operational staff or not? Because the provision of incentive compensation to investment staff, but not operational staff, caused further kind of tension between the two. And that was also identified as the siloing of the two sides was a concern. So it came up in sense that it was discussed during the deposition. In terms of reasons for the termination, no trustee testified that, well, because Ms. Rodell was advocating for more incentive compensation, therefore I terminated her, or therefore that wasn't the reason. I think it may have contributed, but I want to start that. I can speculate there. That's the testimony they gave. One to follow up in regards to the vice chair issue. So this is what Trustee Richards testified to, so I think this is relevant to what your point was. We asked them to identify kind of instances of objectionable conduct by Ms. Rodell in 2021. And so he's referring to the September Kodiak, the meeting in Kodiak. He says, I, based on my conversation with Trustee Moran, left the impression that Ms. Rodell was meddling with the officer appointments for the board, which is a big no-no. What do you mean by meddling? She was trying to keep Commissioner Mahoney off from being vice chair was the impression I was left with. And how was she doing that? Through Trustee Moran, he asked to meet me the second day. He and I went out to dinner. And he asked to meet me early in the morning the next day. And he didn't tell me what it was about, so I showed up to the meeting 15 minutes early to meet with him. And he expressed something to the effect that he had a conversation with Angela, and, you know, he was concerned because the positions, you know, shouldn't hold the chairmanship or the vice chairmanship, and maybe it wasn't appropriate to have Commissioner Mahoney be vice chair. And I remember expressing to him that I disagreed with that as a historical observation, and I didn't think it was an appropriate thing for her to be involved. So that it was, there was some testimony from Mr. Richards, Trustee Richards, about this appointing Commissioner Mahoney as vice chair, and at least what he would perceive as Ms. Rodell objecting to any municipal settlement.
I get to the chair, Senator Von Imhoff, going back to Representative Joseph's question. I think you put your finger on something that is extraordinarily important, is the conflict issue. I'm the commissioner of revenue. I work for the governor. The governor wants an ad hoc draw. I'm also a trustee. The Alaska Permanent Fund. The policy of the fund is opposed to ad hoc draw. That's a difficult position to be placed in. We asked the trustee individually whether, and we asked the non-commissioner trustees whether they received any statements, comments, or actions by the commissioner trustees that indicated they were advocating for the governor's agenda in their role as trustees. And the non-commissioned trustees said no, they did not perceive that at any time and in any respect. And what we concluded from that is even the non commissioner trustees use their fiduciary duties to the fund as investor all last month as being paramount to their maybe political loyalty or obligations to advocate for the governor. So we ask those questions in more than one way to try to make sure we were getting complete and thorough answer.
stuff. If I could real quickly editorialize, we've all had busy years, but this is bringing me back, Madam Chair, to my concern and my thinking when we were looking at this intensely in January and then later at other hearings, that it's crying out for reform. You can't have a commissioner of revenue who's instructed to do X and then has a fiduciary duty to do Y. And this isn't these gentlemen's problem. It's our problem and the state's problem. And I think that you know, we clearly aren't going to rehire Angela Rodell. We don't do that. But I think that we need to reform the way we built this board. And there's some constitutional questions about separation of powers and doing it, but I think we need to look.
Good. Quick interjection.
So Angela Rodell was Commissioner of Revenue at one point, and she served in a permanent fund corporation. So she would be one who would know the trends, the traditions of the permanent fund corporation on whether or not she herself could even serve as the vice chair. Is that correct?
She certainly would have known back history that she was. Yep, of course.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you.
Yep.
I just wanted to thank you. That was my question, but I just wanted to add one more point. Subjective to my comment here, but she might have been looking out for Commissioner Mahoney's best interest.
So moving forward, our last time, I'd like to start on page 64. It's about a page and a half. We'll read through the conclusions. Our council can do that. And then I'd like to provide the committee members an opportunity to give approximately 2-minute closing statements. And that's how I see we'll finish this up.
Thank you, Chair. So ultimately, our conclusions, one, I'd like to start off by saying that we have produced a 65-page single-spaced report. There's a lot more detail about different events, about the events we've talked about, their specific citations. You know, to the extent you have questions or additional clarification, we hope that it's contained in the report. We try to be comprehensive and meticulous in our coverage and our citation. So in regards to the factual conclusions and based on the evidence, we had determined that the trustees did not follow the APFC charter in all material respects with regard to their evaluation of the executive director. The trustees did not use an evaluation instrument or process to assess the executive director's performance that was consistent with the executive director's performance evaluation policy. Trustees lost confidence in the executive director's leadership, and our relationship with several trustees was strained. There were several incidents that trustees testified about that eroded their confidence and trust in the executive director's leadership. The cumulative effect of these of the incidents motivated the decision to terminate the executive director, even though they were not directly addressed through the evaluation process. Collectively, the reasons expressed by the trustees for the decision to terminate the executive director supported the termination as a matter of employment law, and that they were in a valid exercise of the trustee's ability to terminate an at-will employee such as Ms. Rodell. However, APFC's structure and importance as the primary source of funding for general government services and payment of dividends inevitably drew the executive director into political discussions and debates. The executive director, the designated spokesperson for the APFC, took actions and made statements that trustees perceived as being political and advancing a personal agenda. There is no direct evidence or credible circumstantial evidence that the governor knew in advance the executive director would be terminated. There is no direct or circumstantial evidence that the governor directed the trustees to terminate the executive director. Trustees did express a concern about the political impact of certain actions and statements by the executive director. These concerns were a factor the trustees considered in the executive session discussions that led to the termination decisions. These concerns did not rise to the level of politics being a substantial motivating factor in the decision to terminate. It did undermine the confidence trustees had in the executive director's ability to continue as executive director. In order to prevent political concerns from becoming a factor in evaluating the executive director's performance, the APFC would be best served if trustees use an evaluation tool or instrument and process that takes politics out of the question. The charter provisions on evaluating the executive director and the process for conducting the evaluation would reduce or possibly eliminate the political influence in evaluating the performance of the executive director if followed by the trustees. The stability and independence of the fund can only be protected by insulating the executive director from political pressures and political repercussions of doing the job. And I would add as an addendum this, the executive director would be better served by the trustees if they gave her clear and objective performance metrics each year and make clear their expectations for performance and goals for the coming year, rather than the ad hoc, more subjective evaluation method that was used from 2016 through 2021.
If anybody wants to make any comments. All right, Representative Foster.
Madam Chair, thank you very much for the report. I get the gist of all of this, and yes, would like some time to reflect on it. One of the concerning things was the tweet, and you know, that just being so the center of so much consternation and the basis for you know, what seemed to be the basis for a lot of this. You know, and that being one of a number of things, but I think it's a good example of how, you know, tenuous some of that seemed, and it seemed like a pretty factual tweet to me as well. But I do understand that it's much more than that, and that, that it was a general breakdown in the relationship between the executive director and the board. Would have liked to have seen a better adherence, of course, to charter, and so I guess the big question for me, and it kind of all boils down to point number seven, which is, you know, where do we go from here? And I realize it's the board's responsibility to improve its own internal, you know, systems and so forth. But you know, it seems that we've taken a great interest in this, and so how can we also be involved to ensure that it's something that you know, it's going to instill, you know, some confidence so that we don't see an issue like this in the future. And so would like some time, I guess, to digest this. But again, I guess the big question, you know, it comes back to how can this be improved and how can we be a part of it and where do we go from here? So thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I remember Ms. Former Attorney General Richards at the testimony, it was on Martin Luther King Jr. Day this year, expressing dismay and surprise that he was called to this hearing called by the chair, Senator Von Imhoff. The month before, Ms. Rodell had been chosen, my understanding, in London as the presiding officer for an association of sovereign wealth funds spanning the globe. And she was very well respected by a bipartisan group of legislators. She came to Juneau, I believe, in the Parnell administration. In the Parnell administration, and then worked, you know, under the Walker administration nominally, although independently, because she was executive director. The best thing I can say about determination is that I understand, I don't think any of it is good, I don't mean it that way, but I understand that at some point, if there's just a personality difference, there just is, and it's agony, it's sort of like a marriage that has been tried and tried, and it doesn't go well. You can't just go on forever that way, but I believe that, in that similar vein, that October 2021 KTOO article, you see sort of the airing of differences between the director and Commissioner Mahoney, and that is not healthy. I mean, that results in these kinds of things. But at the same time, I don't agree, with great respect for both counsel, with the legal conclusion. I think that the state is going to pay her a settlement. I just do. And that comes from my own reading of many, many cases on termination of at-will employees under this covenant that we've spoken about. I also think that my main concern, because Ms. Riddell is going to be fine. The trustees are going to be fine. But I do believe that the trustees, and I don't mean to disparage any of them, but I'm concerned as a legislator and an Alaskan that they've become infected with politics. And that's a real concern. And you can see that when the administration clearly, my memory was right, that in October, this is a year ago next week, they were clamoring for this $3 billion draw to, in my view, paint the appearance of everything being fine. We just need this extra cookie from the cookie jar. And Ms. Riddell was not an acolyte in that way of thinking. And so we have these unique policy differences that I'm not a student of the Permanent Fund Corporation. It's history, but I don't think this kind of thing has happened a whole lot. So I want to thank our council because they clearly had no agenda. You were just delivering us a report that we asked for and giving us the facts as you see them. And I mean that 100%. So I think that we need to look at reforming the way we appoint the trustees to isolate these decisions from politics the best that humankind can conceive of. Thank you.
No, thank you. I this investigation, you know, the report sort of has essentially found that there's no explicit evidence of interference between, you know, on the part of the administration. I do think that there is an inherent tension when you sort of have two, you have members of the Board of Trustees that have essentially two masters, two sense of accountabilities. And, you know, when it comes to management, you always have to know who your first team is, and that's the team to which you're ultimately accountable to. And I think that when you have appointees to the Board of Trustees, and that their first team has to be the governor, because that's the person that hires and fires them, essentially. It does put them potentially in conflict with the goals of the permanent fund itself. And given the, you know, increased importance of the permanent fund to our state's fiscal stability and operation costs in Alaska, I think that we do have to look at ways of making that less political because it is so incredibly important. I will also say that I think that, you know, there is a lack of agreement between the CEO and the trustees about what was the CEO's responsibility and what was the measure of success is really, you know, largely at fault here. When you look at the measurement criteria outlined on page two that's described in the charter of the executive director's duties, there's, you know, A through E very clearly a set of criteria that include, you know, achievement of goals, general leadership and management compliance with the executive director's charter, implementing board policies and reporting criteria, achieving specific projects and initiatives. That includes, you know, the earnings of the permanent fund. And if the trustees of the permanent fund don't believe that the CEO is, you know, deserves to be recognized for the work product of her team, and the CEO believes that that's the ultimate measure, that's an inherent challenge, an inherent conflict that gets in the way of good governance. And the board's lack of adherence to the charter and consistent management. If there had been consistent management and clear expectations communicated early on, I believe that we wouldn't be having this meeting here today. A good manager has to have very clear goals and expectations for their staff, hold their staff accountable to those goals and expectations, make sure that they have all the tools that they need to achieve that. And when you have, you know, a chief information officer that reports outside of the CEO, but also underneath the CEO, there's a lot of bad governance structure here that, you know, is you know, from a management perspective, this was just sort of inevitable that this was going to happen at some point in time because the structures are not clear, the measurements aren't clear, the goals are not, you know, in alignment between the board and the CEO. And so there has to be a reform of this given, you know, the strategic importance of the permanent fund. And that's going to be for other people to decide since my term ends this year. But I think that if we don't do that, we risk further political conflict within the permanent fund that is now no longer just provides a you know, a check to Alaska. Sure that we can essentially keep the lights on, our schools open, and public safety functioning in the state of Alaska.
Thank you, Madam Chair. First, I do want to thank Christopher Slotty and Howard Trickey and Peter Scully for doing a really nice job. Very complete, very thorough, very objective. I also want to thank Schwabe, Williamson, and Wyatt for coming forward. Proposal and everything. Yeah, it's a situation where, in my mind, that really personality played a huge role. Personalities played a huge role in the determination, more than the performance, because I believe that they did follow an objective means of evaluating the executive director, follow their own charter, follow their own rules. That things could have been prevented. Some of the risks could have been mitigated. And when I say risk, you know, the risk of other employees leaving. We saw improvements happening. And then just all the series of events just in a short, short time frame. It's just been a misunderstanding. And that's what I hate to see is a lot of misunderstandings that lead to really a potential detriment to the permanent fund corporations because our executive director was well renowned, well respected, not just the performance of the permanent fund was recognized worldwide, but her individual performance was recognized worldwide. And, you know, I look at the conclusions, you know, a lot of this stuff just doesn't seem substantiated in my mind, for example, these concerns did not rise to the level of politics being a substantial motivating factor in the decision to terminate. And a lot of this stuff was being perceived as being political. And one thing I guess I've learned from this meeting is that if you have an at-will employee, no matter at what level they're at, the best way to terminate them is to have a statement of lack of confidence or a statement that you want to change direction. Because that there blankets you. You don't even have to have reasons for that, obviously. All you have to do is just make that statement, and you're justified in what you're doing. I don't think this was a justified termination. I do think it was more had to do with personalities than anything. I can see why, if you're an executive director and things are unclear, why you would want to bring in a facilitator into a meeting to try to get clarification and better understanding to make sure everybody's on the same page, because obviously she wasn't able to do it through the previous meetings that they've had, because things have been vague. I also see, I just think that would probably have helped out. However, doing it without the board's knowledge, I think, was a risky move. I would never do anything like that without consulting with the board, making sure they're on board with doing something like that. But it would be an innocent mistake more than anything. It wasn't like she was trying to push her own agenda. I think she was just trying to get some clarifications. The Permanent Fund Corporation right now is highlighted, and it is the discussion that we have year after year, the dividend and the rolled earnings reserve, paying for government or not paying for government, and it's been very difficult. It has been very, very difficult these last 6 or 7 years. When you look at how we make it through our sessions, that's usually it. And so I can understand someone wanting to respond quickly. I can understand why somebody having the tweets or the press releases that were there. I just have not been able to link, in my mind, be able to link it to being something so erroneous or so haphazard to justify. But as was pointed out, it is allowed. I mean, she is an at-will employee. And I hope the board in the future does adopt, and well, they already have adopted policies, but they follow those policies more directly to have more efficient and effective role in what they do. But one of the things I want to point out about the team there, one of the things that surprised me when we first had a hearing on this was the board not recognizing the role of the Legislative Budget and Audit Committee. We oversee the corporation. It's written in statute, and our auditing department is protected underneath the Constitution of the State of Alaska. So that kind of surprised me a little bit that those board members did not know our role and responsibility. And I want to thank the committee members here and our chairperson for pursuing this, because we would be a derelict of our duties if we did not look into this a little bit further, just to see. And I hope this is helpful. I hope this is helpful to the board. I hope this is helpful to the public. I know it's been really helpful to me in knowing what is and what isn't and how things should be or shouldn't be. So thank you very much.
So thank you. Really appreciate the effort you've put in the last 9 months. The result is fair, thorough, and very comprehensive. Really appreciate it. One of the takeaways that I see is that for the benefit of the state, it is imperative that the board remains professional, contemplative, fair, and transparent, versus impulsive and hasty, which is what I think, my opinion, we may have seen back in December. Firing an executive director with no backup plan or transition plan, I think, is not wise. We're one of the largest funds in the world. We provide 60 to 70% of the state's revenue. It is important that the board be as professional and consistent and fair as possible. Interestingly, I do see that just in this last year, there's been three turnover on the board. People who were in the board less than a year ago, last December, three of them are different, half the board. Perhaps this is an opportunity for a fresh start, turnover, new leaf. Clearly, one of the takeaways is that the CEO evaluation process needs to be more robust, more consistent, more thorough, and follow the process. I would like to add that perhaps every year, in the eye of transparency, that this CEO evaluation is brought forth to the LBNA committee. That way, the stakeholders of Alaska, who are the citizens of Alaska, are the stakeholders of the permanent fund. We as elected officials are elected by the citizens of Alaska. We should provide oversight from the board and make sure that the evaluation of the CEO and the evaluation of themselves, are they following the fiduciary annual training? Are they following their own processes? Where's the oversight? Let's stop the sloppiness. Let's make sure it's professional and consistent, and we can be that entity to make sure that happens. I think the last takeaway that some committee members have alluded that there should be some potential change in the board appointment process and structure. I'd like to offer some specific suggestions. It's on the record. Let's get it out there. Number one, through new legislation, potentially, I think we should expand the board to 7 seats. It's 7 odd number. We should have 5-year terms versus 4-year terms. This makes it outside the governor's term of a 4-year term. We should have 2 5-year terms. All future board seats should be confirmed by the legislature. That way, the people of Alaska can weigh in. I suggest that 2 of the 7 board members should be out-of-state seats. We are a globally invested, very large fund. We should look to see
out-of-state people with different perspectives and different backgrounds, since we are a globally invested fund. The governor gets one selected seat, not two. The governor can choose anyone from his or her cabinet, does not necessarily have to be the Department of or Commissioner of Revenue or the DNR Commissioner. These are just suggestions. The evaluation, again, of the CEO should be a public process. The board should evaluate themselves. Are they following their own processes? And lastly, I don't think the vice chair should ever be a governor's appointee or, excuse me, a governor's employee. That should be changed with the bylaws or statute. Those are my suggestions. Hopefully something that's come out of this process. Again, thank you. I want to remind the listening public that all documents will be uploaded here momentarily as soon as I press the gavel. So there's no further questions. I appreciate everyone being here today. Thank you, Council. You did a fabulous job.
Your host is exiting the conference.